Earth explorers, welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are and why we are here and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Tonight, our phone lines will be open all night. If you want to reach us anywhere in the U.S. or Canada, the number is 888-228-4494. Canada, we also have a toll-free number just for you. Lots of listeners in Canada, 877-489-6350. Anywhere else on planet, off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us at 530-776-5154 or 5185. We have not forgot about you people that reach us with Skype. You can simply reach us at BBS Radio. And Pal Talk, we include you as well. It's BBSRadio_com. And don't forget that the solar wind tonight is 606 kilometers per second. That's rather high. But the proton count is way down to 2 protons per cubic centimeter. And again, the sun is blank. And all of a sudden, without announcement of any kind, the Aurora Borealis came on strongly last night. Much to the surprise of the NASA Themis team, who thinks they have the Aurora Borealis source figured out. We do want to apologize to those people who have been accessing our archives lately. When we changed servers, we had some problems getting the archives over to the new server. They are all over now. And some of the video, some of the pictures are not linked yet, but hang in there. We're going to fix it this week. The subscription service is back up and running. So if you have a subscription or had a subscription to X Squared Radio Premium, please let us know by email. We'll put your username and password back in and get you going again. If not, make sure to get to x2-radio.com, sign up for X Squared Radio Archives. The reason these are important is they are divided up into one-hour segments, so if you want to put them on an iPod or listen to them in series on the CDs or whatever, you can do that. And we try to make the audio quality as high as possible. So these are recorded at 128, which will require broadband to listen to, but you could download them and listen to them in there. The audio quality is quite good. In the news, kind of interesting, you know. Sometimes we find things that we think are fictional, and lo and behold, they turn out to be true. Invisibility devices, long the realm of science fiction and fantasy, have moved closer after scientists engineered a material that can bend visible light around objects. The breakthrough could lead to systems for rendering anything from people to large objects, such as tanks and ships, invisible to the eye. Although this is still years off. Researchers at the University of California at Berkeley, whose work is funded by, of course, the American military, have engineered materials that can control light's direction of travel. The world's two leading scientific journals, Science and Nature, are expected to report the results this week. But you get to hear about it first on X Squared Radio. It follows earlier work at Imperial College London that achieved similar results with microwaves. Like light, these are a form of electromagnetic radiation, but their longer wavelength makes them far easier to manipulate. Achieving the same effect with visible light is a big advance. Underlying the work is the idea that bending visible light around an object will hide it. Jing Zhang, the leader of the researchers, said, "In the case of invisibility, cloaks or shields, the material would need to curve light waves completely around the object, like a river flowing around a rock. An observer looking at the cloaked object would then see light from behind it, making it seem to disappear. Substances capable of achieving such feats are known as metamaterials and have the power to grab electromagnetic radiation and deflect it smoothly. No such material occurs naturally, and it is only in the past few years that nanoscale engineering, manipulating matter at the level of atoms and molecules, has advanced sufficiently to give scientists the chance to create them. The tiny scale at which such researchers must operate is astonishing in itself. Zhang's researchers had to construct a material whose elements are engineered to within 66 billionths of a meter. The military funding that Zhang has won for his research shows what kind of applications it might be used for, ushering in a new age of stealth technology. For those of you that don't know what nanotechnology is, you have heard the word nanotechnology much in the news, but you might not know who invented it, why they invented it, and how incredibly small we are talking about. Dr. Kim Drexler at MIT, was the first to earn a dual degree in electrical engineering and engineering of physics. What he was able to do with matter had never been done before. And the interesting thing is, the technique was so simple, once he figured it out, that that's why it's spreading so quickly. And I'll tell you who got involved with it right away. But here was the contest. There was a contest put out, $1 million prize, for the person who could create the smallest motor. So, and we're talking electric motors. One of the competitors created a motor that was so small that you needed a microscope to see it run. Now that's pretty small. Kim Drexler had a better idea. He used an instrument called a scanning tunneling microscope. This is a microscope that uses something like a phonograph needle, only the tip of the needle is only one atom in diameter. And the needle vibrates at about 100,000 cycles a second. And it acts sort of like a blind man's finger. And it goes over the morphology of molecules or surfaces at very, very, very minute tolerances. And as the force is felt at the end of the needle, it creates a current which is then amplified and turned into an image using software. So sort of like a pencil hooked to a person's finger that might be feeling over something, almost tracing the object for you to see. Now, the results are just astonishing, what you can see with a scanning tunneling microscope. But as it turns out, if you apply the energy the other way, you can push protons around using the needle. And so what Kim Drexler did is he designed a planetary gear. A planetary gear is a gear reduction method that's capable of delivering tremendous amounts of torque to a shaft. You have one in your automatic transmission. Only this planetary gear was made out of 4,553 sodium atoms. When he showed it to Bill Clinton, he won the funding that he needed, and nanotechnology was born. Now, as luck would have it, you might think, gee, this is a very painstaking and manual process. And although Kim Drexler was able to write the letters 3M on a smooth piece of graphite, so small that you needed an electron microscope to read it. It was a manual process. And so you might be familiar with a software giant called Macromedia. Macromedia's owner sold the company and used his knowledge of gaming and software to create replicators for the nanotechnology. The first to come off the line were DNA replicators, able to take raw materials and make genetic material from scratch. After that, atomic switches, things that could work like computer chips, only on a molecular scale, much, much smaller than silicon chips, requiring much, much less energy and producing far less heat. And coupled with buckyballs and bucky tubes, these are carbon structures that are made on a molecular scale, you can now see how these machines and light tubes and switches and motors and oscillators and even enzymes can be built by hand. The only disconcerting thing about this is most of the funding does come from the military, not one of those things that instills confidence in the progress of science. Speaking of science and exploration, something else came up in the news today, also a breaking story. A new approach to measuring glacier behavior can keep track of the rapidly changing erosion of ice in southeast Greenland. I'll tell you the reason this is important in a second. Earlier studies focused on two large, rapidly thinning glaciers, but these actually contribute relatively little to the total ice loss, even though it is a lot of ice. Satellite measurements of the island's gravitational field imply a much greater loss than the large glaciers alone can account for. Now, a team led by Ted Skambos of the University of Colorado in Boulder has revealed the disparity by looking at a wider range of glaciers. They used laser altimetry to measure the thinning of inland ice, plus satellite images that show changes at the margins of the ice sheet. Overall, they found that the region is losing more than 100 cubic kilometers of ice a year. Now, this is a fairly short article, but there's a lot of really neat science in this, and we'll talk about this hour, and then I'm going to let you know what we're going to do the rest of the program. First of all, laser altimetry. A lot of people know what that is, but I'm assuming maybe you don't. There is a science called interferometry, where you use a laser beam. You clean the mode of the laser, thus aligning all of the wavelengths of light so that they're not so scattered, but they're all polarized together. And then you beam it at an object, and some of the light will bounce back to the source or to a detector. That distance between those two objects is measured by interfering the light one with the other. Well, the difference between a source that doesn't move at a fixed altitude and ground will be able to tell the difference in altitude to a fraction of an inch. So that's how they're able to tell that the ice is melting on a much larger scale than once thought possible. What they had done before is simply photograph it from space and notice that more and more green is showing and less white from the ice. But that really doesn't tell how the thick layers of ice are actually melting down. The second part that's amazing about this is the statement that the island's gravitational field had changed. That means that the mass of the land mass of Greenland has begun to change, has begun to alter. Now, it's assumed that the reason the gravitational field is changing is because the ice is melting. Maybe not. Maybe the gravitational field is changing because the land underneath the island is changing in thickness. Maybe on the other side of the crust, the amount of mass in that particular area is beginning to erode. These are things that just let you know there might be forces beyond what you know about occurring underneath the planet. Before we go on, I want to give you an Arc of Millions of Years update. The Arc of Millions of Years Volume 3, now an Amazon best pick, is also the number one selling book with Author House. Author House is the largest print-on-demand publisher in the nation. With over 20,300 authors, that is quite a good performance to be the number one authors on that. And we appreciate you listening to the program and purchasing the book. We've had some great reviews on the book, and we appreciate your patronage more than you know. We do have a caller on the line, and we'll take your first name and where you're calling from, please.
Hello, Dr. Agnew. This is Mark from Nashport, Ohio.
Hi, Mark. How are you doing?
How are you tonight?
Oh, I'm doing great.
Doing good. You remember Charles Hall?
Sure, I remember Charles Hall, the tall whites.
Yes. I don't know if you know, but Charles is also a physicist.
Yes.
Well, at least he has a master's degree. He brought up something one time, and I'd like to run it past you and get your thoughts on it.
Sure.
He doubts that time slows down at the speed of light. And he brought up the situation of two particles in a particle accelerator. You have one particle that's going right at the speed of light, and then you have another particle that's going relatively slow. He claims that those particles wouldn't meet because they were in different time frames. I wondered if you had ever given that any consideration.
Well, I guess it depends on if one is in the path of the other. They would be in different time frames. It's a little bit like, and of course it also depends on the gravitational field that they're in. If they're in the same gravitational field, say, in a super collider, and one particle is suspended on the end of a string, so to speak, and the other one's fired at it at, say, 0.9 light speed, when they collide, one is going to annihilate the other. They will be effectively in the same place at the same time. The trick is to get the impact to be absolute 100%, like a total eclipse. If it's a glancing blow, they may not release as much energy, and the particles may not come apart. So that claim, I don't see the physics behind that. If that claim were true, then the CERN supercollider wouldn't function. You'd never be able to collide two particles into one another.
Well, I guess that's what Charles is saying, is that he's arguing that time doesn't slow down at the speed of light because the particles wouldn't collide.
Well, time is relative. The particle that's traveling quickly is not going to age as fast as the particle that's traveling slowly. But again, if they're in the same gravitational field, they are going to suffer the same fate. What happens in heavy gravitational fields is that time becomes distended, and even at the speed of light, it will appear to the outside observer that object is going very, very slowly, even though it's going at the speed of light. So it's all in when you look at relativity, it's all in a matter of relativity. But time does slow down for the object that's nearing the speed of light. Here, and there's a lot of experimental data, a lot of empirical observational data that proves that this is so. Clocks in jet aircraft run slower than clocks on the Earth. Clocks in the space shuttle run slower than clocks on the Earth. So this is something that is pretty well known. We also know that people that live on mountains age slower than people that live in valleys because they're experiencing less gravity.
Huh.
In the heavier
That's
gravity areas, the people age differently. Now, it's infinitesimally small, and it's very difficult to create experimental data because you'd have to say, all right, we're going to live this person's life on the top of a mountain, and then we're going to reset and live this person's life with exactly the same conditions in the valley. But clocks have been tested, atomic clocks have been tested, and it is true. There is a time difference.
Here's another question for you, just something to ponder. Another thought is, if light is moving in a wave, if it's oscillating, doesn't light have to have its own internal clock then? Because an oscillation implies a sequence of events. Like you have to have a beginning of an oscillation and then an end. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. Well, we classically think about frequency, wave function, as something that's oscillating from positive to negative. This is actually a rotational function, something that spins on an axis like a tire. That's the function of light. Of course, we look at it as a sine wave because it's propagating through space. But the sine wave isn't flat like a piece of paper. It's more round like a drinking straw. And the frequency of it is just the distance between the troughs and valleys of that wave. Now, while it's obeying the wave function, propagating through space, you know, like a wave photon, it has certain properties that it doesn't have when it collapses to a particle. I know that sounds really confusing, but Dr. Young, who was actually a doctor, a physician, became fascinated with the human eye and became fascinated with light. And when he did experiments with it, he discovered that when running a single light source through two slits, that now two new sources of light would interfere with one another and periodically cancel each other out, making light and dark stripes on a wall. As long as it was left alone as a wave function. But as soon as we tried to identify the spin of the particles going through the slits, they switched from waves to particles, and all we got were two dots on the wall. Really, really strange paradox. Physicists still do not understand how matter can literally appear to go back in the past and change its function from wave function to particle function. So we just kind of settle on a duality we call wave-particle duality, and that's how we resolve it. So it's not as though there's a start and a finish to it. It is a circle. It's a spin, like a top. It's just propagating through space, and so that's why it looks like a sine wave.
So do you believe that someday that we'll be able to possibly travel faster than light, or will we have to convert our ships into something, some other state that is non-material? Will we have to cancel mass in some way in order to travel at those kinds of speeds?
That's a really good question. You know, speed and time in space is really just distance. We measure distance in space by light years, and it is just distance. If you can take the distance and shrink it somehow by folding space or ducking into another dimension and then ducking back out at the end of the line, then you've accomplished the same thing as though you traveled the straight line, except you didn't travel as far. And if you didn't travel the same distance, you're not going to take the same time. So I think this is much more likely as a solution for traveling across the vast distances of space than just accelerating something faster than the speed of light. That may be the barrier of this dimension, and there's nothing we can do about it. But it doesn't mean that we can't change the distance by going through wormholes, by somehow folding space, or tricking the physics into thinking that it's not quite as far as it is.
Do you remember Lieutenant Colonel Wendell Stevens?
Yes.
One thing that he, one of his cases that he claims to have studied is an extraterrestrial group called the Aldebaran. I don't know if you've ever heard
that story,
right. But that Wendell Stevens claims that the Aldebarans actually met with German scientists before World War II and taught them a form of anti-gravity technology. Have you ever heard of that story? Or?
Well, there are a number of anti-gravity stories out there, and I don't know if I know that particular one.
Right.
I did ask Stephen Greer one time on this program if he believed that some Earth-based force, and I'm not going to call it the United States or the shadow government or whatever you want to call it, has a craft that can make a left-hand turn at 10,000 miles an hour. And he said, yes, they do. In order to do that, you're going to have to create a different gravitational field, because the frame of reference would have to be altered in order to overcome the law of thermodynamics that says any object traveling in a certain direction will tend to stay traveling in that direction unless something moves it or some energy is applied to alter that direction. And then you apply the second law of thermodynamics, which is for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, and it means the left-hand turn at 10,000 miles an hour would smash you flat against the right-hand door.
Right. That's so true. Okay, I got one last question. I'll get off here and let someone else call in. Have you heard about the recent information posted by Clark McClellan, the retired NASA space flight controller, who claims that he saw an 8 to 9 foot alien in a space shuttle loading bay when it was on a military mission?
Wow. No, I missed that one. Yeah. That's a great story.
Yeah, if you want to go out to someday, go out to Project Camelot. They have a link to Clark McClellan's website, and you can read it. That's a pretty wild story.
I'll have to get him on the program. I'd like to ask him some questions.
I guess you would. Hey, thanks for answering my questions. I'll listen on the air then.
All right. Thanks, Mark. Thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. Earth Explorers, we do want to let you know that the phone lines are open all night. Toll-free U.S. 888-228-4494. In Canada, 877-489-6350. And anywhere else on planet, off planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us at 530-776-5154 or 5185. And don't forget, we do take calls on Skype at BBS Radio and Paltalk at BBSRadio_com. We are coming to you live via the BBS Radio Network, the largest internet talk radio network in America, and also the Steel Eye Media Network, rebroadcasting by our friends down at the Kevin Smith Show. If you don't know about his program, you can listen to him every single night at 8 p.m. Central at kevinsmithshow.com. We were talking about interferometry, and yesterday I decided, because I was in close proximity, to go to the Hanford Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. If you have a chance, there are two of these in the United States. One is in Hanford, Washington, which is outside of Richland, which is outside of everywhere because it's in the middle of nowhere. The other is in Louisiana. These two observatories, when possible, work together. It's not very often that they're both running at the same time, but it is important that they do run at the same time because And in these interferometers, I'm going to explain this to you here in just a second, just how sensitive they are. But they're so sensitive that they can pick up cars driving by, ocean waves lapping on the seashore 1,000 miles away, airplanes flying through the air, air conditioning units running in commercial buildings. So they're very, very sensitive. So when they run together, they are able to validate the data that comes in. Obviously, if one is picking up an ocean wave lapping on the beach off the coast of New Orleans, it's not going to be picked up the same as it is in the middle of the upper desert in Hanford, Washington. And so they can cancel that out. They can program it out. But if both LHOs, both laser ferrometer, interferometers, pick up the same signal, then it's pretty good corroboration that they have picked up some kind of external signal to the Earth. Now, we've explained interferometry a little bit before, but years ago, a century ago, the argument was made that the speed of light changes with direction in space, or that two spaceships, one stationary, one traveling at the speed of light, one passes the other, and the instant that it passes the other, they both turn their lights on. The idea was that the light beam on the speeding spacecraft would be going faster than the light beam on the stationary spacecraft. Keep in mind, there's no such thing as stationary in space. But Einstein argued, no, the speed of light will be constant. Both light beams will be traveling head-to-head forever through space. Well, the experiment to prove that Einstein was wrong was put together by a man named Michelson. The Michelson interferometer was designed as a large laser square, like a framing square laid out on the Earth. One of the legs was perpendicular to the travel of Earth through space, then thought to be the ether of space, and the other was parallel to the travel of Earth through that. The idea, the theory was, the hypothesis was, that because Earth is going through space at 18.5 miles per second, the speed of light would be different going in one direction than it would be the other. So they split the laser beam, sent it out to the end of mirrors, and tuned the laser beams so that they canceled each other out. And lo and behold, the speed of light was exactly the same in both directions. Einstein was right. Well, the idea of interferometry has taken many, many advances since then. Now it's used in industry as vibration analysis. You simply shoot the laser beam at an object such as a motor or a plastic case or some kind of moving gearbox, and you want to measure the vibration of this with something other than a microphone or somebody putting their ear against it, and you want to make sure that the vibration is not in certain frequency ranges. For instance, auto parts a lot of times are checked with interferometry during the manufacturing process so that when they run in the car, they don't make any noise. All those little automatic doors in your air conditioning system work that way. They have a little electric motors in there that open and close the doors to blend hot and cold air so they can keep the temperature of your vehicle the same while you're driving. You just set the temperature and forget it. A lot of luxury cars have this, and some mid-sized cars have this. Well, this is the vibration of the motors and gearboxes inside these needs to be very, very quiet because people do not like to hear the electronics or the mechanics of these doors opening and closing and moving around. It would sound like a hydraulic robot underneath the dash of your car. So we check the vibration using interferometry, and that's simply done by measuring the distance precisely down to the micron level, a millionth of a meter, with the laser. And as the distance changes, as it would if the case of this little contraption were vibrating, then the current flow for the transducer in the laser source would indicate a certain frequency and thus reject that part. Well, interferometry has been taken to new heights with the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. There was a theory that was put out by people like Dr. Kip Thorne and Stephen Hawking that gravity from supermassive black holes or from supermassive bodies that collide in space, such as neutron stars sailing through space and then slamming into each other, and keep in mind that that's never or very rarely a head-on collision. This is more like two ice skaters skating at full speed at each other and then grabbing one another's hands and then looping around each other and pulling each other in closer and closer and closer. Obviously, if you imagine that, you see stars the size of our sun, or actually they have to be a little larger, 1.4 times our sun or larger, sailing at each other through space, grabbing each other by gravity and going whipping around each other at hundreds of times per minute, and then hundreds of times per second, and then thousands of times per second until they actually collide or coalesce. We call these coalescing neutron stars, binary neutron stars. And they actually make a sound when they do this. When radio antennas pick this up, they make a sound when they come together. Something like, whoop, like that. No, I'm not going to do that again. But that's what it sounds like when two neutron stars come together in space. The theory is that when two large gravitational heavy bodies like that go zinging through space, they ripple space-time. They actually bend the fabric of space-time. And they send it out a lot like dropping a pebble in a smooth pond of water. The waves change the shape of space. That means that a light beam traveling along the very top layer of molecules of that water, when the water's smooth, the light beam would be one length. When the water's rippling, the light beam would be slightly longer, because now it has to go up over the wave, down into the trough, up over the wave, and so forth. And so the light beam gets longer. Well, the idea was that if they could build an interferometer big enough and make it sensitive enough and quiet enough, control the suspension of the mirrors so that they're not subject to the vibrations of Earth, eliminate all the air from around the laser beam so the laser wouldn't be scattered on any air molecules going through its path, and quiet the electronics and control the frequency of the laser close enough, a fraction of a wavelength if they can do it, then a YAG laser could be used to tell the difference between a straight laser beam and a laser beam that's going across curved or rippling space-time. Well, they make it like a giant framing square because it has a very high probability of being able to detect a gravitational wave. The probability, I say, is high because the only gravitational wave it could not detect is one that came straight down the middle of that right angle, because it would affect both beams identically. But the odds of it coming straight down the center are next to none. Considering the distances we're talking about, the odds of that are next to none. One leg is always going to be affected a little bit different than the other leg. And the closeness of the ripples will belie the size of the object that made the splash in space. The strength or the height of the ripple would belie its size in space. So you have mass affecting the spin. Small objects are going to spin much faster than large objects, although it does seem that they are going to spin at their maximum speed, whatever that is. And large objects are going to bend space-time greater than small objects. So you have amplitude and you have frequency, and both of these are supposed to be able to be detected by the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. It's shortened for the acronym LIGO, L-I-G-O. If you want to find out more about this, you can go to LIGO.org and learn more about these observatories. There are actually four operational LIGOs on Earth. One is in Scotland, one is in Australia, one is in Louisiana, one is in Washington State. If you're in any one of those places, these observatories are paid for by tax dollars. They will let you tour them. They have great staff there that will give you a great tour, let you photograph anything you want, and let you in places that you wouldn't think possible. Are there military applications for the gravitational wave observatories? It's difficult to say. But there is great value in these observatories, because if they can get sensitive enough, and I might add that none of them have detected a black hole yet. In fact, the only thing that they've actually corroborated is the presence of already known coalescing binary neutron stars. But that's a good thing, because at least they're backing up known technology that we already have. And the location of those binary neutron stars is pretty well known, too, because we know the data based on lots and lots of big radio antennas that pick up that information. Well, the LIGO is just very, very interesting because of the technological hurdles they had to overcome. First of all, to pour concrete flat within a fraction of an inch over 4 kilometers long. And then vacuum technology to be able to eliminate the vacuum in these very long tubes in 3 stages. First using high volume pumps, and then using turbine pumps, and then using ion pumps that are absolutely quiet. Keeping the air out of these tubes takes weeks and weeks and weeks to accomplish. And then once the air is out, they want to keep it out, because if air gets back in there, it often brings moisture with it. And the moisture is very sticky and sticks to the walls, and it's pretty hard to get out. It takes a long time. So most of the tax dollars were spent on the tubes and the tubing, and the mirrors, of course. Precision optics are hard to come by, and each mirror costs about $45,000. But very interesting observatories. We are learning a lot about our universe and about the nature of energy and about the amount of technology it takes to make these precision measurements. One of the interesting things is that these LIGO units, one of them is going to be placed in space, hopefully next year. It's called the Laser Interferometer Space Antenna, called LISA. And it's going to have a slight advantage over the rest of these, because the rest of these have to bounce light back and forth between the source and the mirror like 20,000 times in order to get the length of laser beam to be sensitive enough. And the LISA doesn't have to do that, although it could. But it doesn't have to do that, because it can place the mirrors 100,000 miles apart if they want to. And they also get to look over more continuous wavelengths of the gravitational wave than the Earth-based unit, who would have to look back and forth over and over the same few waves of gravity. So interesting things coming down the observatory pipeline. These are going to run for about 2 more years, and then they're going to be gutted and upgraded to advanced LIGO, which is going to be far more sensitive, probably 2 or 3 times more sensitive. By the way, they can measure distances as small as 10 to the minus 21 meters. That is about 1,000 times smaller than a proton. That's pretty fine. So we look for good things to come out of that, and certainly there will be no Nobel Prizes all around if and when they make those measurements. Plus, they would be proving with real observational empirical data that our hypothesis that there are black holes in the universe is sound. Most of the physics community today agrees that there is a supermassive black hole in the center of every galaxy, and we'll talk a little bit about that in our last hour. And we do talk about this quite in depth in the 3-volume series of The Arc of Millions of Years. By the way, we did make an offer on Coast to Coast AM July 2nd. We extended it to August 2nd, and that offer was that if you bought Volume 3, which just came out a couple of weeks ago, a couple of four weeks ago, of the Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 3, that we would send you the link for the audio books of Volume 1 and Volume 2 for free. We will extend that offer to listeners of X Squared Radio for the rest of the month of August. So if you did not get in on the Coast to Coast offer, you can go to arcofmillionsofyears.com or just click on the book cover at x2-radio.com. And by the way, that's A-R-K, like Noah's Ark, not A-R-C. arcofmillionsofyears.com. And click on one of the buy buttons on the left-hand side. Make sure to pay attention to your postage region, whether you're in Europe, Canada, or down under. We will not only send you the autographed copy of Volume 3 of The Ark of Millions of Years, but we will also send you the audio versions via download. And these are broken apart into approximately one-hour segments so that you can burn them to a CD if you want to. If you don't, you can flip them right to your iPod. They're all in MP3 format. And you can listen to the first two books on audio. So if you're not a great reader, don't worry about it. I read it for you. One of the things that we have learned from our many emails is that we get a lot of listeners to this program who are educators and who also are students. Well, we have recently added a great affiliate for you, the Academic Superstore. That's a place where you can buy software, neat tools and gadgets, and even supplies such as calculators and iPod peripherals at huge discounts. And all you have to do is click the Academic Superstore banner at X Squared Radio, and you can start saving. And I can tell you, some of these savings are up to 75%, and they offer free shipping. So if you're in the market for new software, I don't care if it's AutoCAD, if it's Windows, Microsoft, Macintosh, it doesn't matter. They've got it at the Academic Superstore. Great place for educators and for students to get a fantastic discount on stuff. And we also wanted to ask you, the PERSIDs are getting ready to peak. Today is August 9th. In 3 days, the PERSIDs will peak. If predictions are accurate, we are going to see, today is August 10th. We're going to see about 40 to 50 meteors an hour. It should be a really great show in North America, especially if you have clear skies. Now, you're going to have to wait for the moon to set to really see them. So give it some time or get out there early if the moon hasn't risen in your part of the country and you'll be able to see them. Great, great time to just take a sleeping bag out, roll it out in the bed of the truck, get you a pillow, lay on your back and watch the PERSIDs and the great meteor shower coming up. Also, be sure to go to spaceweather.com when you get a chance. Check out the International Space Station flyover link there. We've got a link to it at X Squared Radio. Put in your zip code, and that software, that website, will tell you how many times the International Space Station is going to come over your neighborhood, where to look, and how bright it will be. Many people do not know that the International Space Station goes around the Earth 34 times every day. So you can actually watch it go over 2 times in a single night. Check it out, spaceweather.com. And if you've ever thought about owning a telescope, and I mean a really good telescope, not the kind you get at Walmart, at the Discovery Store, you can find the world's best telescopes. We're talking Meade telescopes. We're talking about solar telescopes, Coronado scopes. They have come a long way. They have motor drives on them. They have databases in them. You don't even have to know much about astronomy. All you have to know is that you like looking at things like nebula and planets and stars, and you never know. You know, in the last 50 years, all the comets and asteroids were discovered by amateurs, because all those big telescopes, they're contracted for years to come by government grants. They're not looking for near-Earth objects, so who knows? You just might save the planet. So plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio. Just click on the Discovery Store banner. Put one on layaway if you want to. They also have free shipping. And if you've got a young child or a teenager that's interested in the Science Channel or Discovery Channel or all those really neat things that NASA does on the NASA Channel, they might be inspired like you cannot believe if they got a really good telescope. That would be the gift of a lifetime, something that just keeps on giving. Now, I know you guys own an inkjet printer. I own one, too. In fact, I own two of them. And I used to buy my inkjet cartridges at a national chain store, and they're expensive. They were running about $35 per cartridge. One of my printers, the color and black cartridges together, run around $80. Well, no more. I discovered a great place to buy printer supplies at 123 Inkjets. We have a banner at X Squared Radio, and if you like this program, they are one of our affiliates, and if you click on that banner, they send us a couple pennies, but they also send you printer supplies, toner cartridges, and you even get a chance to win a free printer. Now, how cool is that? So stop paying high prices. And by the way, you need to add the price of gasoline to those inkjet cartridges, too. Visit 123 Inkjets at X Squared Radio. You get these cartridges in 2 days. They're exactly what you need, and you save money to boot. By the way, I buy my printer cartridges for $14 a piece at 123 Inkjet. So check them out. It's worth it. Last week we ran the archive of Dr. Ronald Mallett. He is the latest developer of the theory of time travel. And he has a great website. You need to check it out if you can. You can find him under the free podcast section at X Squared Radio. If you look at the little podcast symbol with the headphones on right there, top center at x2-radio.com, click on there. We give you an hour for free of Dr. Ronald Mallett's interview with us. That was on last week. This week, I'm going to talk a little bit about the Tesla Tech Conference, or Tesla Tech Expo I was at last weekend. Really a great place to go. I was very privileged to be invited to speak down there, which I did. I gave a speak on a presentation on the upcoming Inner Earth Expedition. We'll talk a little bit about that later on tonight, too. And I was able to meet some of the cutting-edge scientists bringing things like hydrogen power, vehicles that run on compressed natural gas, and energy recycle systems that bring conservation to a much higher level. And by the way, lots of conversation about zero-point energy, and yes, the dreaded over-unity. No proof yet, but it's getting much closer. Very, very intelligent guys, and if you get a chance, you need to check them out. It's teslatech.info. The expo for this year is over, but they have a couple more events coming up this year. Next year, the expo is going to be at the University of New Mexico, as it was this year. I believe it's going to be their permanent venue. Excellent venue. A very low price to get there by air or by car, of course, and very nice hotels in the area. And the university is just fantastic. The venue is clean, it's high-tech, great people there. Get a chance, go to teslatech.info, send them a letter, tell them you heard about it here, and pick up a copy of the DVDs of the presenters from this last weekend. That being said, tonight, coming on in about 6 minutes, we have Robert Pritchard. Robert Pritchard is a very unique individual because he is the logistics and webmaster guru for PestWiki. PestWiki is the pure energy science wiki. You know what Wikipedia is. This is sort of like that, except it concentrates strictly on new energy, clean energy, renewable energy, and it gives a great venue for those inventors who have created or have discovered or are working on energy technology that's going to change everything. I have often said on this program that the best new energy technology is probably going to come not from the conventional sources. They're not going to come from the accredited universities. They're not going to come from the oil companies or the power companies because they're not done selling you what they have already. It's going to come from the attics, the basements, the backyards, the spare bedroom laboratories of the brilliant people all over this country that think all the time. They're tinkering with things. They're making breakthroughs, major breakthroughs in energy, hydrogen generation, cracking of water with very low energy requirements, electric vehicles, all kinds of technology that's going to make alternative energy sources not only available to you, but affordable to you. This is where true energy independence is going to come from. It's not going to come from the folks down at Exxon. This is the guy, Robert Pritchard, who has the connections. He knows the technology that's coming, and he's going to be on our program in about 5 minutes. We're going to call him up, bring him on, and let you fire your phone calls at him, because we want to know, too, where the next magic bullet is coming from. Now, that being said, I need to make a commercial for new energy, because although the government has come out and said that they are going to allow almost $2 billion, $1.65 billion, for new energy research in the United States this year, some of that is for cellulosic ethanol, some of that is for biodiesel, which is near and dear to my heart because we just finished building a biodiesel plant up in Odessa, Washington, but also for emerging technologies. Now, that being said, they make it pretty difficult for these guys to get their hands on the money. You have to write a grant application, and the grant applications are in GovoSpeak. Very difficult documents to negotiate. You also have to have a public authority, like a public development authority or a local nonprofit that works with the city. They're the ones that have to receive the money. The money can't actually go directly to the inventor. Yeah, that's right. So the inventor actually has to find a PDA, a public development authority, in his neighborhood, a little industrial development authority. Every little community has one. Every state's got one. And get them to receive the money and then distribute it to the inventor. It's quite convoluted and very expensive and very difficult to handle. So what we're going to have to do is we're going to have to make an appeal to you once again. If you want new energy technology to come to this country to deliver us from foreign oil sources, there are several key areas where we have made breakthroughs, big breakthroughs. And now it's time to scale up those breakthroughs so that you, the average consumer, can reap the benefits of it. I'm talking about 85 cents a gallon for driving 400 miles. I'm talking about free electricity for your home. I'm talking about clean water, no matter where you live, no matter what water source you use. Clean water. Yes, that kind of technology is available, but it isn't scaled up. You can't find it at Home Depot. You're not going to get it by ordering it off of eBay. Why? Because the manufacturing facility does not exist yet. Why doesn't it exist? Because private enterprise can't receive money from these grants without going through these public authorities. That being said, it's going to have to come from you, the consumer. If you go out and you buy yourself a windmill today, it's going to cost you about $12,000 to $15,000. Is that the real cost of the windmill? No. But what you're doing is you're paying for the next 4 or 5 years of electricity in advance. Those are the kinds of licenses and fees that are put on top of those technologies by the government to make sure that if you're not going to buy gas, you're at least going to pay for it. This emerging technology is going to go around that, folks. But in order to go around that, that means you have to contribute now. So do your research. Find yourself a new energy company. It doesn't matter to me what they make. I don't care if they turn trash into methanol. I don't care if they turn sunlight into biodiesel. I don't care if they take aluminum cans and turn it directly into hydrogen fuel. Find them and send them a check once a month. Call it a voluntary energy tax. If 100 million of you do it, we can change the energy picture in our country in 2 years. In 2 years, we can tell foreign sources to go away. We can take care of ourselves. And the neat thing about it is every other nation in the world can do it too. No war required. Let's take a break. We'll run about a minute and a half's worth of commercials, and we'll be back with Robert Pritchard after these messages.
One of the things we have learned here at X Squared Radio from our emails is that many listeners to this program are educators and students. Well, we have recently added a great affiliate for you. The Academic Superstore is the place where you can buy software, neat tools and gadgets, and even supplies such as calculators and iPod peripherals at huge discounts. The best things for the classroom and for the student are just a tax-free click away. All you have to do is click the Academic Superstore sign at X Squared.
Welcome back, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future, and here the results are always positive. Just a couple more commercials here, and we'll get with our guest. You know, the foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is now in print. It is now an Amazon bestseller and is climbing the charts in other venues as well. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I both know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted this final work of the trilogy so you have the tools to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. And by the way, I do want to remind you that the offer we made on Coast to Coast last month, we will extend to X Squared Radio listeners. If you buy Volume 3 this month, we will send you via download the audio versions of Volume 1 and Volume 2 for free. So you buy Volume 3, we give you Volumes 1 and 2 for free. And if you're not a great reader, don't worry about it. I read the first two books for you. Also, our friends down at NRG Resources have introduced a new engine oil technology. Right now it's called TVT 24/7, and it is the future of lubrication. It is the industry's leading environmentally friendly oil additive that not only increases fuel mileage, it reduces engine, gearbox, and transaxle wear to nothing. The other brands, even the additives like DuraLube and Slick 50, fail anti-friction testing in less than 10 minutes, understanding testing conditions. TVT 24/7 went more than 24 hours in the test and still did not fail. Get tomorrow's technology today by visiting the online store at X Squared Radio and pick up TVT 24/7 Engine Oil Energizer. Our guest tonight is the heart and soul, the pumping neuro network of the new energy movement in this country. We have had many people on this program with new energy technology. They struggle for recognition, they struggle for notoriety, they struggle for investment, but they want to get their information out there so that you know that they're there, and you know what our constant plea is for your funding to go to these inventors so that we can make the breakthrough we need to in things like propulsion, pollution removal, fuel conservation, and energy generation. Robert Pritchard is the webmaster and the coordinator of all this new technology information in their website, Pure Energy Systems. And I believe we'll talk about the website here in a moment. Robert, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's our pleasure. I had so much fun at the Tesla Tech conference last weekend. Got to meet a lot of very bright people. And it wasn't just the conference. It was the late-night meetings in the patio at the hotel afterwards that were even better. We got to hear from people like Ty, who is working with hydrogen vehicles and compressed natural gas vehicles. Brilliant minds. So what's going on in the world of new energy today, Robert?
Well, there's all kinds of neat stuff going on. Probably before I get started with that, I probably ought to give you a little bit of background on how I ended up getting into Pure Energy Systems Network via Sterling Allen. Let's say about 2 years ago, after my last official corporate job, I was eliminated at a software firm. And from there, I prayed about something I could do that would give me gainful employment while being able to work out of my home. So I began the Renewable Energy Resource Center. Since then, it's been changed to the Three Rivers Synergy Center, and essentially it's morphed into the Alternative Energy User Group as a nonprofit organization. We've had some excellent, excellent speakers come and talk to us. They wanted their 15 minutes of fame, and they usually end up with about an hour or so each. But their presentations so far have been incredible. And they're just from folks around here in my neck of the woods coming and doing stuff in the alternative energy environment, so I don't feel like the lone stranger anymore. I've always prayed that the right people would come across my path, and it's been happening, so I think that's really cool.
Well, that's good. That is fantastic. We believe that when opportunity meets preparation, this is when miracles can really happen. And it's kind of neat how the training of a person, the adversity that a person goes through, actually ends up building the muscle that person needs to do the task that really makes them great. And in that respect, I guess, we should be thankful for the adversities that we face and overcome.
Well, I think I'm still a spiritual wimp.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Well, as of April 1st, I became a full-time employee of the Pure Energy System Network and became a full member of the New Energy Congress under the direction and coaching of Sterling Allen. Among the various responsibilities I have, you kind of talked me up a little more than probably I really am doing, but I have been trying to improve the Pure Energy System Wiki, and the website is peswiki.com, or like he likes to say, PezWiki. And so part of the stuff I do, I've been adding registrants so they can participate in the wiki. I've been raising the visibility online and off the website, and much of what can be done from my home office that I've had here since 1996. As a member of the New Energy Congress, I also get to go out and check people, prototypes, and properties and either help identify them as offering products that are reproducible or finding their frauds or scams. If they're real, we promote them, champion them, and help them find funding resources so their inventions don't get suppressed or destroyed. If their items are found to be fraudulent, however, we say so on our website, so this process can be a two-edged sword. We're working on a more official certification process as we add more members to the NEC and continue our voting system in either elevating products and technologies in our top 100 list or demoting them as others take their place in the list. And so this has been a marvelous learning experience for me.
Well, I understand the necessity for information availability. One of the things that inventors do best is invent. They sit around and tinker with things. They break through the paradigms of energy. One of the things that we wrestle with all the time in physics is the restraints or constraints put upon ourselves by the total energy available in the system. We sort of resigned ourselves to saying energy can neither be created nor destroyed, and there's always going to be losses. So we do the best we can with lubrication, and we make up the rest with horsepower.
Well, I know I worked for 13 years under the Department of Energy, and I was always just, you talk about constraints. There are ways to do certain things, and Department of Energy always put obstacles in saying you can do it, but here's the ways that you cannot do it. And that always just mind-boggled me as to why that was the simplest, easiest way to do it, but the Department of Energy wouldn't allow it to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, that's always been amazing to me, too. But that's why we say on this program that the great breakthroughs are not going to come from Exxon. They're not going to come from the power companies or the universities, because it takes someone that's able to step outside that paradigm and realize that maybe energy is just around the corner. We just need to look around the corner for it.
Well, we know it's quote-unquote in the ether.
Well, I still think that the greatest breakthroughs are going to come out of attics, back rooms, basements, you know, sheds, from either retired engineers or active engineers that are working and either underemployed or, as you said, frustrated or constrained at their place of employment.
The mother of necessity.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I do when I interview engineers to hire, after we ask all the normal questions like, where do you see yourself in 5 years, is we ask, you know, what do you like building? What are you doing with your spare time as an engineer? And every single engineer I've known in my life has some kind of project that they tinker with. I don't care if it's cars or airplanes or water purification or wind energy. There's always something that they're tinkering with. This is where the great brilliance is going to come through. But without a resource like PezWiki and New Energy Congress and New Energy Movement, these awareness groups that are bringing money and manufacturing capabilities and you know, the public together into one cohesive, I won't call it a cohesive force, but I'll call it a cohesive awareness effort. At least there's the possibility that one of these new technologies could actually emerge and end up in the local Home Depot.
Well, I think there's probably about 100 of them out there. At least we've got them listed as the top 100 out there on our website. And we keep changing it. It goes up and down, and depending on where they're at in the level and how much effort's going into them.
Sure.
it's just exciting to watch this thing happen, and I'm supposed to eventually get that thing so it's automated, but right now it's rather manual on the website. Eventually I'm supposed to be able to make that happen on a monthly basis, and right now it's kind of happening on a six-month to an annual basis.
Well, I understand that. You mentioned how much effort is going into it. I want to make the audience aware that this effort is inversely proportional to the amount of Wheaties that's in the food storage cabinet. If there's no food in the cabinet, no effort is going to be made on the new energy technology. This is why we ask listeners to this program to assign themselves a voluntary tax. Get yourself down to PezWiki. Check out the top 100 energy technologies that are there. Great write-ups on it. Pick one. It doesn't matter to me. And start sending that person some money. $20 or $30 a month. If a couple million people do it, new energy is going to emerge, and it's going to be uncontrolled by the grid, which is a good thing. And it will actually reach the people in a way that will set us free in more ways than one.
Heck, if it was just $1 a person from a million people, that would definitely be a feather in that individual's cap.
It would. Now, when you think about how much you spend on gasoline now compared to 2 years ago, the average family was spending about $200 to $250 a month on gasoline 2 years ago.
And now they're spending, a choice.
Now they're spending $500 or more.
That's right.
Back in 1995, the company that I work for produced the most electric vehicles of any producer in the country. Seven vehicles were entered into a national electric vehicle contest. Three of them came from our company. And we won every category. But
are you
going to
get
that
back into the XPRIZE thing for 2009?
Well, as a matter of fact, I am 20 miles away from our warehouse, and my assignment for this week is to get our electric car out of mothballs, polish it up, replace the batteries, replace the tires and wheels, and we are bringing the car back out.
Okay. Well, you're going to have some competition from Ty Robinson, because he said now he wants to get his hydroxy vehicles into the XPRIZE competition as well.
Well, I say the more the merrier. This vehicle won the Pikes Peak Hill Climb and broke the old record by 2.5 minutes.
Cool.
This car is... I'll put it this way. You put this car in second gear and you have an automatic transmission for in-town driving that's unbelievable. Not only will you go 300 miles on a charge, but if you step on it, you're going to smoke the tires off this car.
I want to see it.
Yeah. Well, there's a picture of it. We've got an article that we've just dug up and released to Popular Mechanics that's going to run.
By the way, you don't live very far away from me either, so I had to just sneak over there sometime.
Well, define live. Because the biodiesel plant that we're finishing in Odessa, Washington, will produce 8 million gallons of biodiesel from sources like canola oil and algae oil, and it's upgradable to 16 million gallons, hopefully within 12 to 18 months of opening. It's doing 16 million gallons a year. This is a co-op effort between the farmers who grow literally hundreds of thousands of acres of wheat in this area. It's the most productive wheat-growing land in the world.
Right.
But they also rotate into their growing mix canola, and canola is a great oil seed. It helps their wheat production in years following when they run canola, and it also produces fuel security and great low-temperature fuel. Huh?
Do you know whether or not they're going to be doing camelina?
Yes, we'll be doing camelina. It doesn't grow well in Washington State, but it grows fairly well in Montana. So they are going to be bringing canola oil or camelina oil over and camelina seed over, which can be crushed right alongside the canola.
Okay.
The nice thing about the camelina seed is the meal is very high in omega-3, and it makes an excellent chicken feed. Omega-3 fed to chickens produces a very, very healthy chicken meat, which is a premium in the market. So this plant not only produces fuel, it also produces a high-quality meal for animals. No chemicals are used to extract the oil like in other plants, so all the meal that's produced is a very high-quality organic meal.
Now, the fuel that you're creating, is it going to go for diesel vehicles or is it going to go for gas vehicles?
Strictly diesel vehicles. A lot of people do not realize it, but this nation runs on diesel fuel, 35 billion gallons a year. Every truck, every bus, every barge, every train runs on diesel fuel. If you bought it at the grocery store, it got there by diesel. So the idea is, and a lot of people have said, well, gee, aren't the oil companies going to block you from doing this? No, not at all, because at each one of these biodiesel plants that are built, and by the way, this is one of the nation's only continuous manufacturing facilities. It does not use batch processes. It keeps the cost very, very low for a cost of canola oil or canola processing into biodiesel. Each plant that opens relieves a little bit of the capacity problem we have with our refineries, which the oil companies actually like. Rather than dumping cheap diesel fuel onto the market, they can now make upwards of $35 a gallon for chemicals that can be made from that same petroleum.
For plastics, cosmetics, you name it. Yeah,
yeah, durable goods, things that last. One of the things that just...
The President of Shell Oil was on Glenn Beck, I think it was last night, on TV. He was talking about a barrel of oil has only so much gas, so much diesel, so much other stuff in it. And when people talk about a barrel of, they're referring about this crude oil that is segmented between all these different products. And so a barrel of oil isn't going to be a 55 gallons of gas or 55 gallons of diesel. And right now the country is underproducing diesel at the moment. That's why I guess the price is as high as it is.
Well, that's true. And by the way, a barrel holds 49 gallons, not 55.
Oh, bummer.
Yeah, a barrel of oil is a different than a barrel of, like we see barrels in our country. So it's even smaller than that. And you're exactly right. Unless you're confident as the American public and listeners of this program that oil is going to go back down to $30 a barrel or that somehow Congress is going to allocate enough money to build three or four new refineries in this country in the next 10 years,
oh, let's give it up for Congress. Yay.
Yeah, this is the path forward. This is the path forward. Now, the nice thing, well, there are actually four really nice things about biodiesel. Number one is it's environmentally friendly. If you spill it on the ground, it's not hazardous. If you burn it in your car, it's clean. Number two is it returns the lubricity to the fuel removed by taking the sulfur out. So these older engines, which are being destroyed daily by this low sulfur diesel that's now being pumped throughout our country, can last and last and last for years and years by just running biodiesel. And the third benefit is it's cheaper. It is cheaper to produce biodiesel than it is to drill for oil, haul it to the United States, run it through a refinery, and distribute it from where the refineries are to every gas station in America. Biodiesel would be regionalized, which means each pad, that's a district of fuel security in our country, there are five of them, could become fuel independent as far as diesel goes, which means shipping costs and thus the cost of the fuel would be brought down. So that's the third benefit. It's cheaper. The fourth is it's renewable. It never runs out. You're turning sunlight into fuel, and you're creating revenue for our own farmers, which is kind of cool.
You're talking about the algae process, right?
Yeah, the algae process is even neater. Canola produces between, 110 and, on a really good day, 140 gallons of oil per acre per year. And it takes quite a bit of energy to get the oil out of the seed and to plant the seed and to harvest the seed and to transport the seed. But algae is a little bit different. Algae reaches densities of 4,000 gallons per acre. It grows 24 hours a day. Well, it grows while there's sunlight, but it produces oil 24 hours a day. And it produces 365 days a year. It's a steady flow, and the costs are even lower because now there are no tractors, there's no plowing, there's no fertilizer, there's no pesticide. All you need is flat ground and water nobody wants to drink.
Well, I've got this GreenStarUSA.com business card from you that looks like it's got algae things on top of your business card.
So right.
I'm assuming the Green Star Products, Inc. is actually doing the algae method as opposed to doing the seed or the animal fat method for creating the oil. Is that correct?
Not as opposed to. Now, we don't use animal fat anymore. We don't use palm oil. But it's in addition to. The algae and the canola and the camelina are all needed on multiple levels. So, yes, algae probably, if it could be brought to large enough propagation, large enough operations, it could probably replace canola oil. But we don't want to do that. What we want to do is supplement it. We want to grow both worlds. But
okay,
as far as animal fat and palm oil and those kinds of things, we definitely are moving away from that.
Cool.
And next month, the 16th through the 19th in Delhi, India, is the World Algae Biofuel Summit, and we'll be represented at that event.
All right.
So there's a lot going on, and
well, can I tell you a little bit more about what I've been doing?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I've been as part of Pure Energy Systems Network. I was also able to participate recently in the 10th annual Soul West Fair in Jondé, Oregon. That happened the middle of July, well, actually towards the end of July. And I was able to demo a hydroxy system in a Ford cargo van that was on loan from my youngest brother. And in that beast of burden, I've been able to double the mileage in it with a combination of frictionless oil and a hydroxy unit. So, along with the, and I found that the hydroxy units work a whole lot better with a diesel vehicle than it does with a gas rig. There's a lot less electronics you have to mess around with.
Sure.
And it's just been a lot of fun. I also would like to be able to, the next project is to be able to go to something like a Bob Boyce machine. But, you know, this technology has been around since 1804 for internal combustion engines. I didn't realize before I got into this thing that that had been around for as long as it has been. It was one of these, I guess you could call it a suppressed technology.
Well, yeah, it was one of those kinds of technologies that when oil was discovered in the late 1800s, prohibition was implemented to take alcohol off the market so that the oil companies could sell gasoline and put that in engines instead of alcohol, which is was almost exclusively the fuel of Ford vehicles before the oil companies took over.
Mm-hmm. I found that with these hydrogen engines or the hydroxy systems, this is really a grassroots technology, and it's completely doable by any shade tree mechanic or what I call a transportation tinkerer.
Well, it's true, and it is grassroots. When I was going to BYU, one of my well, he wasn't my classmate because he graduated before I did, but Roger Billings had a fleet of buses that ran in Provo on hydrogen. Now, they were a little foggy in the wintertime, but they ran on no gasoline, nothing but hydrogen.
What year was that?
This was 1975, and I thought,
dang, you were there a year before I was, or about the same time.
I thought in 1980 we would be off of gasoline as a fuel. And I talked to Roger last year, and I said, Roger, what happened? How come we didn't, you know, sweep the nation with hydrogen-powered vehicles? And he just said the country wasn't ready for it yet.
Well, that meant that really the government couldn't tax water, so it didn't happen.
Yeah, that's kind of what it boils down to.
You remember the Stirling engine?
No,
how that was supposed to go into vehicles?
Oh, this was the engine that just ran off of water.
Right. Well, actually, it was the process of going back and forth of the gas inside from heat, from hot to cold. And it was a Stirling engine. Originally, it was supposed to go into a vehicle, and I think the U.S. Air Force actually had a few of these things there in Utah. And there was also, I understood there was a bus route in Utah where you could go from one side of the state to the other for something like between 25 and 50 cents because on this particular bus.
Wow.
But that was a long time ago.
Well, what happens to this technology, Robert? I mean, you know, the technology's out there. It's practical. It's tested in a city bus environment. It's obviously robust. It's low cost. How come it doesn't take off? Why doesn't this technology just come out and get produced and people have a choice?
Well, we're trying to get that to happen, but I think it's mostly because of the men in black and what I call schoolyard bullies who go and they threaten the individual who's got this technology, is just about ready to get it out to the public, and threatens them and their families because the vested interests, whoever they are, catch wind of this stuff, and they make a big deal out of it, and they squash it as soon as they can. Either they buy the people off, or they outright steal it from them, or and some people end up 6 feet under.
Yeah, I've definitely heard those rumors and actually have felt the sting myself, although I didn't really fight it off. I just kind of backed away from it and went around it and just kept going my own way. And it really hasn't bothered me since. But
well, that's what we have to do with Pure Energy Systems is if we find individuals out there that are in that particular situation, there is another route that they can go besides trying to make $1 billion off of a technology that they know is the latest and greatest thing that's going to save mankind. And that's with an open source process. We do have that in place so that they can open source this thing, kind of like Bob Boyce did, and the people who are threatening their lives then go away because now it's open to everybody and everybody can make it themselves. However, we also have the process in place where they can license that technology as open source and still make money off of it. They're not going to be the first ones to invent it, they're not going to be the last, but they're probably going to be the first ones to actually make some money at it.
Mm-hmm. Well, describe to us a little bit about open source. How does that work? How does an inventor come out with his idea? He's got a few thousand dollars his family has loaned him. He's put together a prototype that won't fall apart like a daisy smack with a nine iron. What does he do next?
Well, very much like what has happened with the open source process and software. You have the technology out there where everybody can, they have the plans. There might be a little piece of the secret sauce that might not be completely there. You know, kind of like you do with a patent where you don't provide everything. And then there might be some support activities going on there where they're going to want to pay for something that's going to be added to it to work properly. So this mm-hmm. is where they're going to make the money, is at this support process, just like in the Linux community where Red Hat's doing it with the Linux environment. Linux came out as an open source operating system, but there's an awful lot of maintenance and support and stuff that has to go on there. So people will pay for service to have this done. And it's the same thing with this technology of alternative energy solutions where you've got something out there. Bob Boyce has got at least two forums online where he's providing support and information out there on that. But if you want a kit or something like that without having to make it from scratch, you can get that.
Well, that's interesting. Well, I know there are a lot of, well, let's just call them specialists out there. Like, for instance, you know, in my career, I spent 29 years in the automotive business building high-speed manufacturing systems and making manufacturing systems run leaner and lower cost and faster and make less mistakes. When I decided I wanted to get involved in new energy, I found out that those skills were painfully missing from this industry. So I searched for a company that I could have some synergy with who had the other skills, have the technology, have good working prototypes, that wanted to go scale up and get into manufacturing in a reliable, high-quality way. And it took a while to find one, but I found one. And now we've opened a brand new biodiesel plant. So, you know, there are specialists in machining, in electronics, in physics, in chemistry. How do you hook up these experts with the team to sort of form a support team so that this technology can emerge and become viable?
Well, we find people like Brooks Agnew to come to our rescue.
Yeah, but I can't be everywhere.
No, that's true.
There are lots of Brooks Agnews out there.
That's true. There are. And they can come to us and they can offer their services. We have been actively working with some individuals who are fronts to organizations that have a lot of money and resources available where they're searching for products or manufacturing items that can be brought. Well, in one case, we've got one guy from the Midwest. I'm calling him the oxidizer for the Rust Belt. He's out there looking for manufacturing or products or things that could actually be airlifted and brought over to these GM plants that are now vacant, and he's able to pick them up for a buck a piece.
Sure.
And he's trying to populate those plants with new technologies that can hit the ground running, and so the people in those communities can get off welfare, or so that those communities don't become ghost towns with these multi-million dollar facilities that are ready to go right now.
Oh, I can tell you, as a quality engineer, my last 5 years I spent as a Six Sigma quality engineer, it's a running joke in General Motors. There's only one thing more plentiful than GM supplier plants, and that's former GM supplier plants. If you go down to Fort Worth, Texas, there's a place called the Metroplex. It's a ghost town. Broken up roads, burned out streetlights, yards that haven't been watered in 5 years, and millions of square feet of manufacturing buildings sitting empty. They have compressors in them. They got transformers.
They've got all of the equipment, including all of the office computers and everything still intact. All they did was they locked the door and walked away. They left everything in place.
Exactly.
And these cities are saying, please, somebody come and help us. We'll give you a dollar to take this over.
Right.
And he's in a position where he's scouting out this stuff, and we're in a position to be able to help him find those companies or products or stuff that can go there and make that happen. So
this,
it's a win-win situation right now.
Sure it is. Sure it is. This little community in Odessa, it's a town of 900 people. They had a million bushel flat house. A flat house is like a house, a big steel building that you fill up with wheat. They have an auger in the top of it, and it literally fills this thing all the way to the ridge with wheat. Now, since CRP was invented, there isn't as much wheat grown as there used to be in this area, so the flat house went dormant. For the last 15 years, that flat house had nothing but spider webs and RVs stored in it.
Ouch.
And we've converted it into a biodiesel plant. It's now a taxable piece of real estate. It's using power. It's created 19 jobs in a community of 900 people. It's a win-win for everyone. If
and your,
new energy
and your
can
process, your process could be stamped all around the country.
Yeah, sure. And so can all of these. One of the young entrepreneurs that we met at the Tesla Tech was Ty. What was his last name?
Ty Robinson.
Yeah, Ty Robinson. Well, he is not only a great speaker, he's also very charismatic, and he's very energetic, and he drives a truck that can run on five different fuels.
Right.
Really amazing stuff.
He's also a member of our New Energy Congress. That's how come I know who he is.
Well, I do want to remind everyone, we're now at the bottom of our second hour, that the phone lines are open. So if you want to call, talk about New Energy, get in touch with Robert and tell him about your latest invention and how to get a hold of the New Energy Congress. Our phone lines are toll-free in the U.S., 888-228-4494. Anywhere in Canada, toll-free, 877-489-6350. Those of you that are using Skype, you can reach us at BBS Radio. And if you're using PalTalk, you can reach us at BBS Radio _com. And if you're using a regular cell phone or if you're using a Magic Jack, you can reach us at 530-776-5154 or 5185. This is a subject that touches the lives of everyone. If you've got a little red LED burning in your house, on your CD player, on your computer, on your VCR, or on your plasma screen TV, that means you use electricity, and that means that you are potentially a customer of one of the inventors that we are talking about tonight. It's important. Energy is what makes the world go round. I think if everyone had access to clean water and energy, not only could we live in peace on this planet, but we might learn to live in harmony with it without the pollution that we've been suffering. So now we have the phone numbers out there. So let's talk a little bit about emerging technologies, getting to the prototype stage. And you mentioned that there are lots of foundations out there that have money. One of the things that we mentioned in our first hour about access to capital is these inventors can't often access this kind of money because it comes from nonprofits and it has to go to a nonprofit or a public development authority. What is the New Energy Congress doing to work with the PDAs around the country to get them interested in new energy?
We're just making ourselves available to them and getting the word out there. We're actually changing our business plan such. We've got a guy down in the Bay Area in California who's helping us revamp our business plan to the point where investors are going to be coming to us because they can smell money in what we're doing as far as the certification process and pulling the folks out of the woodwork, getting them out of the paranoia stage and their ideas and concepts and prototypes to the point where it looks like something that's feasible and can produce money. This is a fun place to be in at the moment. And they smell a lot of money in what we're doing. We're probably not smelling as much as they are, but they see a great future for alternative energy solutions. And that's why I'm here, is because I'm excited by the fact that we've got a solution to the doom and gloom that's going on in the world and the constant crises that happen by those who want to take away our free agency. We now can say we not only know the individuals, but the technologies and the people who are doing the good stuff, they can help, quote-unquote, save mankind.
Sure. Sure. And what are the main areas of research that are being done? Are we talking about technology that cleans up water or technology that generates electricity or technology that can be used in transportation?
All the above and more. We've taken a shotgun approach out there with the top 100 list. If you go out there and you look at that list, you're going to see everything is touched.
I was sitting down with the Economic Development Authority of the state of Kentucky last year, and eight guys sitting around the table, and we presented a business plan for a company, a manufacturing facility that we control in eastern Kentucky, and we were presenting some new energy manufacturing ideas to them. And although they were very helpful with ideas like labor reimbursement and tax deferring and utility discounts, the funds to actually, you know, put tools on the ground and jobs in the place was a little slow coming. But the most puzzling question came from the head of that Economic Development Board. This is a little town called Williamsburg, Kentucky. And he said, why Williamsburg? Now, keep in mind that the mayor of Williamsburg, or the county judge executive from Williamsburg, was with us there. And he was a little taken aback by that statement. And I said, I'll tell you why Williamsburg. Because Williamsburg and little towns like this have empty manufacturing facilities, sometimes hundreds of thousands of square feet. They've got lots of people out of work or people that are driving 70 miles to another city to find work. And they need jobs. And the companies that we represent need labor to put their materials together and get them on docks and get them shipped.
You got it.
And they said, well, but we have contract manufacturers all over the state that are looking for work. And I said, that's not true. And this is what I brought to his attention, and you correct me if I'm wrong. Most of these contract manufacturers have a very narrow range of things that they do. They either make wheel bearings, or they make brackets, or they make cables, or framework, but they don't step outside their area of specialty, and I don't know a single one of them out there that will take on a new energy project. This has got to be an emerging manufacturing support group.
No, you're absolutely right. I think we've gotten to the point where we've become so specialized in niches, very much like the Japanese cottage industry, where you've got the blinders on, you can only do one thing. Well, we don't have to do just one thing anymore. This country was based on people who were multidisciplined. We probably need to go back to that kind of mindset and get away from, I can only do one thing.
Well, I understand the I can only do one thing mentality, because you want to reduce the tooling, you want to reduce your training, and you want to reduce the variation in your outgoing product. You want to reduce your inventory. I guess what I'm saying is, what we need is an industry that springs up nationwide that specializes in bringing new energy technology to the Home Depots of the country, because the average consumer isn't going to find that little one-man manufacturing plant in the middle of Nebraska.
No, our mindset right now is, if we want to have something manufactured, nobody in the United States will do it, so we ship it to Red China and have it manufactured there, and then ship back here for sale.
Funny you should say that. The electric car, we have been in conversations with Asian sources the last 90 days, and they have been just flipping out, absolutely just grabbing it as fast as we can feed it to them to go into production with the electric car.
They're
we can
hungry.
Actually produce the car for, I don't know, less than $7,000, which is certainly in the price range of most Americans.
Mm-hmm.
The funny thing is, we could actually build that car right here in the U.S. for about the same money, but can't find the support group to do it.
Well, we'll work on that. We need to get you tied in with this guy who's fronting 60 organizations. He calls himself the spearhead of an army.
Interesting.
He's got about 60 organizations that he fronts, and this is just one guy. Let me tell you about one company that's here in the Tri-Cities. I don't think I'm going to be messing up their non-disclosure agreement that we signed with them by doing this. But the name of the company, if you go to our website, peswiki.com, and type in the search section, Green Power, you'll find them. And we've got their videos and pictures and all the other information about them. What they do is they take municipal waste products,
mm-hmm.
run it through a reactor with their proprietary catalyst, get it up to 680 degrees or so, and run that into a cracker stack, which is just like the rest of the petroleum industry, and they create 8 different products out of that stack in a matter of minutes. This is abiotic oil, the same stuff people pull out of the ground. You don't have to pull out of the ground anymore if you can take that out of your municipal waste, and you're getting rid of two things. Well, you're actually getting rid of something that's now an eyesore and people can't get rid of all over the world. You're running it through this process where it comes out the other end, and oh, by gosh, you can actually make money at this stuff now.
That's exactly right.
It's the same with the dams that were created here in the Northwest. They were initially done as flood control. But, oh, by the way, you can create electricity off of these things. So the electricity was essentially free to the Northwest as a result of dam control. Well, now we've got a process where we're eliminating municipal waste out of landfills. We're not playing the methane game. We're playing a thing where we're actually converting it into real live petroleum. This isn't biofuel with a shelf life. This is stuff that is the same as if you pull out of the ground. They're making each one of these units 130 feet wide or long, 20 feet wide, and about 3 stories tall. We convinced them that they needed to go ahead and have these things stamped all over the country, not just here in Pasco, Washington. And through that process with this guy who's now getting these places all over the country, he said, well, maybe I can get 10 of these put in a city. I'll take a number of states, and I'll try to sell it in those states. 2 weeks later, he called back, and he says, I'm not doing it for anything less than 50 at a time. I am inundated with calls from people who want this in their communities, and I can't handle the traffic. So I'm not doing anything for less than 50 per, and each one of these units costs like $20 million apiece. So you figure 20 times 50 is how much is coming happening right now.
Well,
now,
let
also,
me ask you a question.
The money?
The units themselves, are they manufactured in Pasco, Washington, or are they manufactured
on site? They're
going to
be manufactured in those communities because those communities have these GM plants where these things can be built.
Good.
Yes. Not only that, but there's bonds, money available, no interest, plus there's millions, billions of dollars in federal grant money for alternative energy solutions, and this fits that scenario.
Yeah, and keep in mind, you have to work through the public development authorities in those communities.
The money will actually come from
the grant, go to the community, PDA, and then to the project itself.
Right. When we talked to Dallas, Texas, he said, you're right smack dab in the middle of petroleum country, and they said, we don't care. We want this technology.
That's exactly right. Something else that they should keep in mind, the PDAs, by charter, they can't build value.
PDA stands for what?
What they do is they do joint ventures by having the people that actually own the real estate actually deed the property over to the PDA.
Gotcha.
And then the PDA uses that as an in-kind investment, and that's how the joint venture is created. It's a really neat way to go around the cash requirement to qualify for the grant. Well, that's very interesting. You know, when we were kids, we always had the joke, you know, there's good news and there's bad news. The bad news is the aliens are here. The good news is they eat trash and excrete gasoline.
Well, it works for me.
Yeah.
I've been over to that plant. These guys are getting people coming in from all over the world. They're flying them in to Pasco Airport, taking them down there, wining and dining them, showing them this technology. And those governments and cities and military organizations are putting cash in the barrelhead for this technology right now.
That's good. That's exactly what we need. Exactly what we need. And they do the same thing, you know, with the biodiesel plants too. The one we just finished has been visited by, you know, senators and congressmen, and the governor hasn't come by yet, but we expect her to drop by someday soon.
Or the one after her will.
Yeah, probably after the headline
is made
in the Wall Street Journal.
Right.
That's when they'll come by. Not enough votes in a little 900 person community. However, you know, the last governor election in Washington, it was less than 900 votes that made the difference, wasn't it?
That's correct.
So these little 900 person communities could be just the ace in the hole these politicians need to make the jump. Now, a little bit about politics in energy. I was listening to the candidates the other day. Don't really do it that often because I have to wash my hands afterwards. But I was listening to Obama on one night. He was talking about how wonderful biodiesel was and how wonderful all the emergency energy technologies were and how he would be meeting with the big three automakers his first week in office to make sure that high consuming or low consumption vehicles were coming down the pike. And then I heard him two nights later, and he was cursing biodiesel as the scourge of the planet, and that he was going to do whatever he could to, you know, eliminate it, that it was harmful to the economics, it was hurting the world economy. And I thought, what in the world is going on in the politics of energy? Can you tell me?
Yes, somebody else is pulling their strings, and they're going to say anything they can to get elected. Enough said.
Wow, yeah, I guess so. I'll sell anything and do anything just to get elected. I guess it depends on who the audience is at the moment.
And if people have short attention spans, they're not going to pay attention to the fact that these guys have said one thing one day and said something else the exact opposite 2 days later.
Well, that's amazing. I was encouraged, though. John McCain has been a very steady supporter of emerging energy technologies and has literally hooked his campaign wagon to the new energy star. And I don't think he's going to let go of it. I think he's going to hang on to it okay.
Well, I hope so, but I really feel for whoever gets that office, because wherever they are, they're going to become prematurely old and gray and wrinkled.
Isn't that amazing?
It's the top of the Peter principle.
Yeah.
You know, the epitome of the Peter principle is the presidency of the United States. I wouldn't wish anybody to go into that position.
It's interesting. Maybe as a nation or as a world, we have outgrown the classic system of our politics. Maybe it's time for a presidency instead of a president. Each member of the presidency with a specific area of concentration, like domestic or foreign or, you know, energy and commerce. Maybe we're changing as a world.
Kind of like a presidency with two counselors.
Yeah, a presidency with two counselors, and then maybe we should repeal the law that allowed senators to run for election, and they should be appointed by the state legislatures so that they could truly be elected on a local level instead of a nationalized political level the way they are now.
We could limit term limits.
Well, I think that's probably a good idea, but some changes would have to be made. For instance,
we know that everybody, no matter how honest and well-meaning they are, after 4 years has been compromised by those who are in control.
Well, it's probably less than that, because congressmen have to run for office every 2 years. So that means the day they get elected, they have to pick up a staff and start fundraising for the next election 2 years away. 2 years goes very, very fast. Since that's really the House of Commons, what we should do is change the terms to 4 years, limit them to three terms, pay them $500,000 a year, and let them take care of their own retirement. And senators should be put at about $5 million a year and let them take care of their own retirements. And we should put the president at somewhere around $50 to $100 million a year. Then maybe you'll get the brightest minds taking those jobs instead of the most willing puppets.
We already have a corpogopoly.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. But in some case, you know, the president making $400,000 a year is listening to an executive who makes $400,000 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've been to Washington enough times, you will figure out that it's just a loose coalition of bureaucracies. It's not really
the other Washington.
Yeah, it's not a top-down organization at all. It's just a spending organization.
Yes.
Well, it's very difficult to talk about energy without talking about politics, either local or national, because there have been some great minds and there have been some great inventions that have come along in the last 50 years from Rudolf Diesel on forward.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't seem to make it to the dinner table, and that seems to be locked up in more in politics than it is economics.
Yes. But there's also the existing legacy systems in place, so I'm being politically correct here, that don't want competition. And so they're going to milk us for everything, every dime we've got, until we can't spend anymore. And then after they realize that they've basically squeezed all the milk out of the cash cow, then they'll say, oh, we have this other stuff in the wings that we think you might be interested in. And
yeah,
then they will allow it to come in.
We call that the PlayStation syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now we're in PS2, but the PlayStations that can really blaze, probably what would you call PS5s, they're already invented. They're just not going to release them to the market until everybody has played the PS2, until they're bored with it, and they've
made
all the money they're going to make.
Yes.
I think maybe it's time that we jump a few generations. When I was in Europe, I rented a Peugeot that was a turbo diesel. Now, this car would flat scoot. I mean, it was fast, and it got 44 miles to the gallon.
Why didn't you get the Beamer that could go 80?
Yeah, or the diesel electric that can do 75 miles a gallon.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how come we don't have these in this country? What happened?
Politics.
I don't get it. I mean, how many people would elect a politician that brought a 70-mile-per-gallon vehicle to the showroom? Everyone.
Well, I think the showroom folks in the country are the ones that have pushed the lobbyists to the point where they're the ones that are pushing the politicians to say, no, we don't want this in our country. It's mind-boggling to have the parties that be in power right now saying no, no, no to alternative energy and also to existing energy sources for drilling, say, offshore, whatever. We know that that's basically a paper process and leasing thing, and it's going to go to Wall Street, and there probably won't be a single oil well drilled in the oceans off the coast of the Pacific, the Atlantic, or the Caribbean in our day. But one of our people there at the Tesla conference basically said, it's a paper shuffle game. And after he said that, I kind of said, okay, I understand what's going on now. Do you agree with that?
Wow. Now, that's amazing. Say that last statement one more time, because that's pretty powerful.
It's a paper shuffle game for Wall Street for our offshore drilling for the United States. And that's what everybody's fighting about in Congress. Who's going to get the money?
Huh.
There probably won't be a single well drilled out there in the Pacific or the Atlantic, but the lease for that property is where the money is, not what's down underneath the floor of the ocean.
Wow. Well, we have a caller on the line. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from, please. Do we have a caller on the line?
Hello?
Yes.
Hello?
First name and where you're calling from, please.
This is Lyle from Indianapolis.
Hi, Lyle. Welcome to the program.
How are you doing, Dr. Agnew?
Oh, I'm doing wonderful. How do you like the program tonight?
It's good. And I forgot, I came in a little bit late. What was your guest's name?
Oh, this is Robert Pritchard from New Energy Congress. Runs a website called PezWiki.com.
Well, good evening, Robert.
Good evening.
I had a question for both of you. I had seen recently over the net, one of them made the nightly news where there are some inventors that are getting, one that's getting, using Brown's gas to run a car, but the twist was he wasn't using brown gas by itself. He was using Brown's gas and gasoline, and later on in the news program they say how he's trying to market it to the big three automakers. And I think recently there was in Japan they had come out with a car, one of their car makers that had come out with a car that ran on water. So I was wondering, and it was there for a couple of days and then nothing. The same with this the guy that's using brown gas and gasoline. He was in Florida. So what do you think is behind that?
Well, we actually have the stuff on our website about both of those. If you search on our search section on our website, you'll find that information out there. We actually investigated the one over in Japan. It turns out that it's really a hydrogen to electricity process, so it's not truly a water car. It's really a hydrogen fuel cell process generating electricity, and that's what's making the wheels turn on that vehicle.
Interesting.
The other issue about the Brown's gas versus the fuel, that sounds like a graphite hydroxy system, which is basically taking the, you know, your engine only is about 20% efficient. When you use a hydroxy system, you're actually boosting that efficiency probably up to about 50%. Now, if you can get more hydrogen going in there with a really robust hydrogen process, if it's a gas engine, you're going to have to advance the timing on the engine so that the cylinders are popping at the right time instead of going in reverse, because hydrogen burns quicker than your hydrocarbon does. But you're looking at gas, diesel, or even liquid gas in an engine with a hydroxy support system where it burns the fuel completely. When you have a vehicle like that, the air coming in is dirtier than the air coming out the exhaust. So if you're using a hydroxy system, you're actually cleaning the air instead of dirtying it. So if you want a hybrid vehicle, you'll get your tax credits from the federal government, but you'll also be cleaning the air instead of dirtying it with a hydroxy system. That's the reason why I've got it in my diesel truck right now.
Wow.
What is the main disadvantage of using Brown's gas? I don't think I've come across...
Brown's gas is exactly the same thing as hydrogen. It's just under the Brown's name. It's the exact same stuff.
Okay.
Now, is this boom gas or is this hydrogen?
Same thing. Boom's gas is hydrogen. The hydroxy system basically is a simplified system where it keeps the oxygen in there as well as the hydrogen. Mm-hmm. What you're talking about with the Brown's gas is it removes the oxygen from the system and you've just got pure hydrogen coming out of it.
Exactly.
This is what Ty Robinson is doing in his engine with his vehicles.
Well, the guy that came up with this system, what he had invented, he had first invented a welder's torch that ran on water.
That's it. And these things are actually produced in South Korea. They've been doing it for like 20 years. They're wonderful machines. They're kind of big and boxy, but they do the job. Larry Ojai in Mallet, Idaho, actually sells these things, and he's been doing it for quite some time. He was actually at the show, and I got to sit with him.
Excuse me, the conference.
But we've got that information on our website as well at pedswiki.com.
Now, this is a supplement to gasoline, so he's using some gasoline and some hydrogen, and what he's doing is greatly extending his fuel mileage.
Correct.
Okay.
In my case, I'm doubling the fuel mileage in my vehicle, but I'm also using a frictionless oil from Marin International. They've been doing this like for 30 years, making this stuff up in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. They did it for the North Slope process where the vehicles had to run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Or, you know, if they went off or got turned off, they'd never turn them back on because it was too cold. So they needed a lubricant which would keep these engines from tearing themselves apart over time. So they brought that down here. I've been using it for 15 years. It gives me like 10 more miles to the gallon. It's called Power Up with an exclamation point. In Canada, you can buy it in any auto store, but here in the United States, you actually have to go to a dealer to get it from a dealer around the country.
That's interesting.
A combination of that with a hydroxy system, I was able to actually double the fuel mileage in my vehicle.
Wow. Now, you are running a gasoline vehicle or a diesel vehicle?
No, it's a diesel. And diesels are so much easier to work with than gas vehicles. With gas, you've got to mess around with all kinds of electronics. With a diesel, it's a compression process. With a gas engine, you're messing around with a spark.
Uh-huh.
So diesels are so much simpler to work with, really. And that's the other thing is, why are we messing around with gas vehicles for internal combustion engines when we should be using a diesel environment?
I agree. Totally agree.
Is there any... In the news report, they were saying that he could have used just the hydrogen to run his car. How much if you were to go across country, how much water would you need?
Now, you're looking at, for those systems, you're going to have one unit of water to between 1,600 and 18 units of hydrogen coming out of that one unit of water. When you're talking ounces, quarts, or gallons. But you're going to need a whole lot of it in order to be able to do that to run a hydrogen engine because you're talking well over 57 liters per minute in order to be able to burn just hydrogen in an engine without burning something that's a hydrocarbon.
Well, so, keep in mind, too, you're not going to be able to just pour water in your tank and take off because...
No, it's not going to happen.
Because the rate at which you make the hydrogen cannot keep up with the rate at which you're driving. So what you're going to have to do is make hydrogen overnight and then drive during the day. And it's pretty difficult for a vehicle to carry enough hydrogen gas to go further than about 100 miles.
True. And in my system, it's an on-demand system, so there is no storage. In Ty Robinson's system, he has two tanks in the back of his Hummer, and these are big tanks, and he can go 60 miles with those tanks full of hydrogen gas.
Right, right.
That's his limit on that. Then he's got to switch over to natural gas to take it the rest of the way.
Right.
Has there been anybody that has been taking a look at or trying to find out how Tesla ran a car from, I guess, the zero-point energy?
Now we're getting into something that we would call GEET technology by Paul Pantone. We've got the information out there on our website as well on that. The plans are available. They're open source. You can go out there and get them. We've got them on our website. This is a plasma technology when you're starting to talk about moving things into, what was it, at the conference session that we had, they said there's no such thing as zero-point energy because how can you measure a zero and how can you measure a point? What was the other thing they called it? It wasn't zero-point, it was something else. Do you remember?
Oh, man, I don't remember now exactly what he called it.
It had something to do with magnetism. Anyhow, Superlight, that was it. It was the presentation on Superlight by Malinsky.
Oh, okay.
Yes, that was it. I love that explanation. We're talking about the speed of gravity being 10 billion times faster than the speed of light. This is that technology where we're looking at the spiritual side of things as opposed to the physical side of things with electricity. We're looking at magnetism on the spiritual side, which I thought was another cool thing, a concept they talked about there at the conference. So, yes, the technologies are there, but if you want something for an internal combustion engine, you probably want to look at the GEET technology. It doesn't take much to make one of those things. And last Sunday night, we listened to Paul Pantone from the hospital that he's in, the mental hospital he's in Provo, Utah, and he talked to us about his system and how it works. Paul Pantone's system is actually used in helicopters in France as well as jeeps outside the country, and also his technology is taught at the university level outside our country. However, inside this country, he's being painted as a crazy person.
Huh.
But outside this country, he's respected by the rest of the world.
I thought, how's his chances of getting out? Because I had run across the GEET technology, and I was heard his story, and I thought they had let him out by now.
No. He's in good spirits. Here's where we can get the donations going for his legal defense. But we've got that out there on our website as well. If you go to peswiki.com, type in either GEET, in the search section, that'll take you to the information and the links to John Fiala, who happens to be his legal representative. By the way, John Fiala was also in charge of all of the communication systems and the videotaping and stuff that was done at the Tesla Tech conference this year.
Huh. So, I just find this very interesting. Why would a guy be in a mental institution? What in the heck is... Who institutionalized him?
His former wife and the people who actually talked to him at a Tesla Tech conference. They started at $50,000, saying they wanted to buy his technology. They went up to $5 million. He still said no. And he said, look, we can put you away. We will put you away. And we will have you in prison for 10 years. Somebody else overheard him, and they turned around and said, just kidding. Well, the next thing you know, Paul Pantone is in prison. Well, actually, he's in the mental hospital, and that's where they're holding him, by an unjust, corrupt political system in the state of Utah, of all places. You would think that they'd have honest people there, but apparently
wow.
There's a number of dishonest people in that organization that won't even hear his case. And he's been in there for 2 years. He has not been released. My grandmother worked at that mental institution in Provo, Utah for years, and she retired from there. What they have going on right now is their financial situation is they're shanghaiing people off the street because they're getting paid by how many people they have in the institution, not by another funding source. They're actually pulling people off the street because they get paid by how many bodies they have in there.
That's crazy.
That's beyond crazy.
No pun intended.
That's criminal.
I reckon so. Well,
And there are a lot of Paul Pantones in this country. He's not the only one.
Wow.
All you have to do is basically get written down in a legal process that a person is incompetent, and they can be put in a mental institution.
Wow.
At least in the state of Utah. So the laws need to be changed. The people who are in there need to be booted out of their elected positions, and we need to get good, honest people in there. My experience with finding good, honest people is that they're too good and too honest to go into politics.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that is just stunning. That's just stunning. I you know, but the energy technology, even though he's in the institution, what about his lab work? What about his prototypes, his papers?
It's open source. You can go to our website, watch the videos. There's stuff out there we've collected from YouTube and Google. All that stuff is out there on our website at peswiki.com. You can be fascinated by this stuff for days reading and watching this stuff on our website. And that's just one of many different technologies that are available today for helping mankind.
That's amazing.
But he's in there because he refused to sell his technology off and have it bought out and have it suppressed.
So now his technology is open source.
Yes, it is.
And we have more bright people out there getting ready to try it and bringing it out.
They're not only trying it, they're using it on a daily basis, and they're using it all over the world. It's another grassroots activity, but we've also got others who are manufacturing this stuff who are putting this in the processes outside our country.
Wow. That's just mind-blowing. Just completely mind-blowing. I don't know what to say about that. It just seems like it certainly has the appearance that that somebody picked up the phone who had a little bit of power and maybe a little bit of financial influence on local law enforcement and decided to remove someone who had enough technology to take energy in a different direction.
And the problem is it can happen to anybody in the United States right now. That's
wow.
We're sitting on the brink right now.
Well, hopefully with programs like this, which, you know, hundreds of thousands of people listen each week, tune in, listen to the archives, or listen live, and we can get the word out and make some changes about this. Lyle, what do you think about
that? That's why we're here. and that's why I'm involved with this, because this is exciting, it's positive. We can overcome the doom and gloom. We don't need to be listening to people who are fear-mongers.
Mm-hmm.
There's a better way. There is enough and to spare.
Yes, there is. Enough and to spare. And even if all of these inventors brought their technologies out and in their lifetimes saw it come to fruition beyond their wildest dreams, it still would not impact the energy market significantly enough to make a financial difference in those businesses, the very businesses that feel threatened.
That's right. And I've always had this belief, and all the jobs that I've ever had in my life is teaching somebody else to take my place, because there was always enough work out there. It was never going to dry up. So people shouldn't have been afraid of their jobs and having them taken away from them. So,
right.
So, and it's the same with businesses. Even in the hydroxy business, there are lots and lots of companies doing exactly the same thing right now and getting these units out there. But if one company wanted to corner the market and hold the cards close to their chest, they would be weak and unempowered. But if they allow everybody to be able to do this kind of stuff, then it's not zero sum anymore. It's additive. And everybody is blessed.
Yes. Yeah, exactly right. And that's what it is. I mean, we're talking about access to energy for people who don't even access energy right now. They're not even in the energy market because they can't afford it. They either don't have a car, they use public transportation, or they've taken themselves off the road because they can't afford to drive. They can't afford to spend $450 a month, which means they're not buying automobiles. They're not going to the mall. They're not taking vacations because they can't afford it. Putting energy in the hands of these people where they can participate in these activities is good for the economy, and it doesn't hurt any one industry.
That's right. I want to get it through the thick skulls that if people are not spending, there's no tax revenue.
Well, Lyle, what do you think? I think Lyle checked out, went back to Indiana, but that's okay. He listens faithfully, and he usually calls in with the most amazing questions. He stays up on just about all this stuff. One of these days he's going to have his own talk radio program. There can't be too many.
Can I hit you with some principles and practices that I found from the Tesla Tech Conference?
Yes, absolutely.
Have you got a few minutes? Well, working at Pure Energy Systems Network jives with the doctrines and principles of the gospel I grew up with, and one of which is following the admonition of Paul the Apostle, where he said, "We believe all things, we hope all things, we've endured many things, and hope to be able to endure all things. If there's anything virtuous, lovely, or a good report or praiseworthy, we seek after these things." And I also believe the principles of doing good to all men. These are Judeo-Christian beliefs I hold dear. And many of the extraordinary technology conference attendees apparently hold those same beliefs I do. And we all felt the overall experience of it being spiritually uplifting. So how could it possibly have happened at a technology conference to have a spiritual awakening going on? Can you figure that out?
Well, that's a pretty good question, and I like the idea that you use the word spiritual awakening rather than religious awakening, because it's a very different thing. When you hear about new energy technology or you listen to a scientist make his presentation and you feel inspired, it's not because he's a great preacher or because he's a Jew or a Christian or a Muslim. It's because the principles that he's teaching about are true. And truth resonates with any being.
That's true. And we had all three there. We had Christians, Jews, and Muslims, and we found common ground.
That's right.
Well, I was there, the aha light kicked on inside.
Very good.
We were looking at magnetism as a spiritual force and electricity as a physical force. That was a new concept for me. What I saw from my background was kind of a homogenized gospel. Where I saw the love and the light of Christ, we were talking about magnetism as a force. Instead of wickedness, we were talking about dark energy. Instead of salvation and justice, we talked about the welfare of Paul Pantone and the other Paul Pantones in a crooked, corrupt judicial system. And we also gave alms to help his legal process move forward. And being in tune with the Spirit was discussed for holding the faith-based Mojo Cell. Did you hold one of those? Moshe Daniel called it having a positive attitude in order for the Mojo Cell to work right. You know, we had a similar device that only worked well when those who were holding it didn't have a spirit of contention with them. In the Book of Mormon, we called it the Liahona. And, you know, Alma in the Book of Mormon also said that, indeed, angels do visit men and women and children on earth. We talked a lot about off-world messengers at the conference. Yes, they do exist. And we may have possibly discovered how they travel from a presentation by Maury King and something that he touched on about traveling in space. Also, Michael Riversong, he's another NEC member. He acted as the MC at the conference. He played both the flute and the harp and called himself a biblical bard. James Barr talked about pulsing electromagnetic healing and the Rife Barr devices. Omar Amen spoke about parasites. My takeaway from his conversation was you never lay down on the beach naked, and don't kiss pets or eat uncooked food.
All good advice.
Dr. Leonard Horowitz spoke of the perfect circle of sound, the ninth core creator frequencies, vortex-based mathematics, solfeggio tones, and the effects of prayer on water. I thought that was fascinating, about how by praying, it changes the properties of water. He also invited us to the Concert for Living Waters concert during the summer solstice. So, to me, this made perfect sense. And by the way, he wants me to help him on his promo, a video probably next week or so, up in Santa, Idaho. Here is a very Jewish guy who loves being Jewish, and he's been living in the center of what used to be neo-Nazi country. I don't know how he does it, but, you know, he's just fantastic to listen to and to talk to. Terry Fiala talked about the speed of gravity is probably instantaneous, but we learned at the conference that actually this magnetic force is 10 billion times faster than the speed of sound. I'd never heard of that before.
Well, I knew that it was faster. It's actually been measured during eclipses and when the light, starlight, emerges after the eclipse. It's been measured at several hundred times faster than the speed of light, but we're not really sure exactly. We haven't done precise measurements on it, but it's clearly faster than the speed of light. We do have another caller on the line. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from.
Hi, this is Mark from Albuquerque.
Hi, Mark. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Brooks. Hello, Robert. Good evening.
Good evening. Did you make it to the Tesla conference since you were in Albuquerque?
Well, yes, I did. I was. I came because Brooks was there and spent some time with him, very special time, and I just called to thank you both for what you're doing.
Oh, I appreciate
it so important.
So much.
Well,
it
you know,
so
if you go to our PESwiki.com site, I've got a whole page just dedicated to the Tesla conference with photos, photo gallery, and also business cards I was able to collect from others that were there. And I've got links to them and their sites. If you find something out there that I didn't get put on there, please let me know.
I sure will, but could you just go real slow and say the site? Because I know I'm trying to write it down real fast, and I can't, so I'm sure other people that are listening are having a hard time, too.
Sterling Allen likes to call it PESWiki, but it's PES. It stands for Pure Energy Systems, and it's a wiki, W-I-K-I. Now, the reason why he created the wiki in the first place in 2005 was that the Wikipedia website wouldn't allow him to put free energy information out there on their site, so he created his own as PES Wiki, or Pure Energy Systems. And that's how it all started.
Okay, so it's PESWiki.com?
Correct.
Okay. Yeah, it's a great website. It's got tons and tons of resources on it.
Thousands of pages. It'll keep you busy for a long time just reading through
it. I'm sure it will. Thanks again for so much you're doing, and don't forget to keep the spirit in the science, because that's the key.
Amen. Thanks, Mark.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Yeah, I agree with that, too. I was one of the things that amazes me about new energy technology is the almost inspirational method by which it comes out. These are certainly bright men. I know in my presentation I showed some technology that the Tibetans had built in the year 646 that looked amazingly similar to a Tesla coil. In fact, I overlay one over the other in my presentation, and the dimensions are, they're undeniable.
Yes.
Now, the fact that the Tibetans received an idea that they could build something that would open a stargate, and Tesla in the late 1800s received the same thing, only he had the skill set to know what to do with it, and he ended up building the Tesla coil and really brought electricity to a useful level for the average person. And I made the statement that Thomas Edison was a bystander. I really didn't mean that Thomas Edison didn't bring a lot of great technology to the world. He did, because he was the fastest runner to the patent office. But the idea of electricity came from Nikola Tesla. And make no mistake about it, engineers, even electrical engineers today, really still do not understand what electricity is.
Well, I think we learned a little bit more about it at the Tesla conference. I liked what you talked about, the Magna Plasma Bullets, Stuka,
oh, yeah,
the Aurora Borealis, as well as the Fourth Dimension Stargates. I thought that was pretty cool.
That's all the latest cutting-edge physics brought to the idea of ancient archaeology. And we have another caller on the line. Your first name and where you're calling from, please.
This is Lyle from Indianapolis.
Hi, Lyle.
I'm sorry, my battery in my phone died, and I have another phone. And I wanted to talk about what you just talked about. I have a degree in electrical engineering, and I had to take anybody in electrical engineering had to take a course in solid-state physics.
Sure.
And the thing that got me was how they modeled it. You had electron and holes, and the holes could move. And I remember our teacher said, basically, what she was saying was, we don't really understand it, but this is how they modeled it, and this model works.
Yeah, exactly. So tell me more.
Do you remember the right-hand rule and the thumb and the fingers?
Yeah.
Whatever happened to the left hand and the thumb and the fingers? They left that part out.
It chopped off in some way. But, you know, so, and I heard an analogy of what Robert, you were sharing with somebody else had called zero-point energy, that there's no zero and there's no point. But what I heard it referred to as energy flowing from a higher dimension to a lower dimension.
Well, we call that the force, or we call it the spirit of God, or, you know, the power of the sun or the son of God. We're talking
right.
about basically the same thing using different words.
Right. I agree.
Well, are we trying to say that...
There was another question I had for you on stubble. Have you heard of Stubblefield?
Yes.
Okay.
Of course. You're talking Wayne Stubblefield?
Well, I can't make that assumption, so I ask. But how many people have been working with that? Or is anybody working with that now?
Enlighten me to what you're talking about. Sorry, I don't know what you mean.
I'm sorry, the Earth batteries. Because this was something that was done in the early 1800s.
Oh, yes.
I
went over that with Sterling about 2 months ago. We do have some information out there on PezWiki.com about the Earth batteries. This is where you stick the rods down on the ground, and you've got a potential going across from rod to rod, correct?
Right, using
yes.
copper and steel plates.
Yes.
There have been a few patents on this in the patent office. People used it to run clocks. There was a gentleman named Miucci who demonstrated it, and he had a telephone system that he could use, and he demonstrated it, and the likes of Nikola Tesla. I'm trying to remember, there were some other noteworthy scientists of that era that attended his demonstration. And he offered, and I can't remember where he was, but he offered to do the city lights for the city that he was in for like something like $14,000 in the 1800s. That was a lot of money. They turned him down, but... I guess he figured out the system to do it, and he was able to, on his own property, he was able to light up his property, and people didn't know with these big, what were they called, arc lamps, I believe. And
yeah, you're talking about
arc lamps, and he was just having the light come from the earth itself.
Right.
It's very interesting. And
I bet the public utility district came to his place and told him to yank.
Yes, he has a page or two on his website that talks about that. And
yes.
talks about the patents also.
Correct. Have you ever stood at the bottom of a high-tension power line tower without the ground being put into the ground from that tower?
I tried not to. Especially with the research. Well, we had to do some research on it.
Well,
so
I've done that,
I
didn't get electrocuted by almost.
I know about the effects,
yeah. Yeah, because you're dealing with the same thing. You've got the potential from the ground, but you've got these high-tension power lines all across this country that are putting incredible amounts of power into the ground. So when I heard about this thing with the potential of the plates being so far apart and being able to generate electricity coming across those, my first question was, how far away are they from these high-tension power lines which are bleeding this stuff all over the country? That's one.
Remember, this was back in the 1800s, so they wouldn't have had all those back then.
True. It still works because you're dealing with the same stuff that comes from lightning, right? And how many lightning strikes do we have every day coming off the earth?
Not very many.
Right. I would just point out that in the earth batteries, they're not using a big antenna. It's what's in the ground. And the other thing was it was between trees. So I'm not sure if I'd have to look at it a little bit more to say whether I'm not sure if that's the same thing that's going on. Because with lightning, you have certain conditions where you have, really the lightning is coming from the ground going into the sky.
True. But the earth is alive, okay?
Right. The earth is alive. I'll agree.
Ron Knott gave his presentation. He's selling his business because he wants to retire. But his presentation was where he lived on a mesa, and on top of the mesa, they were getting lightning strikes all over the place. So we ended up sticking these little antenna units, lightning arresters. He calls them dissipators. Basically, they're a bunch of stainless steel rods that are like a brush or a broom that's been opened up. And at night, even during the day, you can see the corona around these things, the blue light. But as soon as they put those on the corners of this mesa, all of the lightning strikes stopped.
Interesting.
He's been doing this business for 25 years. He wants out of it because he wants to retire, and he was trying to find somebody to buy his business from him. It's super simple. Not a single one of these things ever failed. The military and other organizations have bought his products for years, and they put them everywhere around the world. These dissipate that energy into the atmosphere without making it a lightning rod. Basically, it dissipates this thing out as a blue aura, and when you can see that aura, the darn thing's working.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see if you could actually capture that energy and utilize it in some fashion.
Well, of course you could utilize it. It's just, it doesn't have enough amperage, to generate
wattage. You can use it now for a nightlight. If you like blue at night, you got a nightlight. I'm being facetious.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you, and I'll echo the thank you from the last caller. It's good to hear Dr. Agnew and what he's doing and his expedition, and you too, Robert.
Well, thank you.
On the wiki page. That's wiki page.
Yeah,
thanks for calling in, Lyle. We always appreciate you calling in. Make sure to call back anytime.
All right,
there's one more
you.
Thing that I thought was really cool from John Maluski.
Yeah.
And that was his magnetite process. Now my wife has got two green thumbs and two green elbows. But he's saying that with this magnetite, and he showed the slides and stuff, where ground, which was basically, you couldn't grow anything on it, you put the magnetite on the ground, and then these fantastic flowers and plants grew almost nine times bigger than they would have been normally.
Wow.
And his explanation was, you've got monopoles, a north monopole and a south monopole. The north monopole comes from the sun. We found out from the sun that you've got these reverse tornadoes up there where all the energy is at the top of these tornadoes and there's less energy down at the surface of the sun. Here on the earth, it's a reverse effect. The sun splits the north and the south magnetism process, it pumps out the north pole or the monopole to the earth, and if you look at the leaves and you look at the feathers of birds, they've got these funnel shapes to them in the veins.
Yeah.
And the feathers, and those are acting as collectors of the north monopole. Now the plants with the magnetite, what it's doing is it's creating, it's collecting the south monopole and bringing that up into the plants, and the chlorophyll process is where the north and the south poles come together and create the energy that makes these plants go crazy.
How about that?
That was something that I said, well, I need to get myself some of this magnetite because I want to put this on our garden.
Well, I was watching that, how he had cans of magnetite, and then what he would do is he would actually coagulate or condense out precious metals out of the magnetite by melting it in lead in a forge.
Well, I thought that was the black sand that he was talking about, where he put it in a microwave for 45 minutes and was able to get ruminium out of it?
Rhodium.
Rhodium, thank you.
Yeah.
Where it was going from, what was it, $10 a ton for the black sand and then converting that into $10,000 an ounce for the
It's $50 a gram. Yeah, $50
okay.
a gram for rhodium. I used to buy it by the ton.
Well, I understand that you can actually buy it from a place over on the East Coast area of Canada, but you need to buy tons and tons of the magnetite. I'd like to be able to just go into the store and buy it like a can of Depot for a bag of fertilizer and use the magnetite.
Right, by the black sand. But wasn't it interesting what he was doing with water, sticking it down in there for a little while and letting it magnetize the water?
Yes.
And when you open a bottle of this water and touch it to your lips, you actually get a static shock on your lips as you're starting to drink it.
Like sticking a 9-volt battery on your tongue.
Yeah, but it's very energizing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of interesting that all he uses was magnetism to make this water
the spiritual source.
Right. Exactly. And it brought it, you know, home. And actually, this water wasn't very expensive because, really and truthfully, there wasn't any energy put into it. It was all natural stuff.
Right.
Just the magnetism was taken from this magnetite.
So anyway, I just thought that was just cool.
Well, that's why I like the Tesla Tech conferences, and I was just lucky to be invited. I had spoken at a UFO expo last year out of San Jose, and John had heard me speak and had invited me to come to the Tesla Tech this year, and I was just honored to be there, honored to be in the same group as you guys. And I hope to try to be involved next year in some respect, if not a sponsor, then a presenter.
Did you get a chance to listen to Charles Ostman in his presentation about nanomaterials? And he basically finished off with showing the magnet motors and the rotorless helicopters and the wingless planes.
Nope, I missed that presentation, but that's pretty interesting. The company that I work for right now was the major shareholder in the rotorless helicopter business. In fact, there's a film of my boss standing underneath one of those helicopters when it did its test flights. And
cool.
these helicopters were whisper quiet, too.
Mm-hmm. That's right, because they're using a special element. What was it, kind of like, they called it Element 51. I wonder why. They use this in this quote-unquote magnet motor unit that is super quiet, and it's using the magnetism process for zipping around. Now, you were talking about the late-night meetings over there at the hotel where Ed Grimsley was handing out these night scopes and looking up into the sky.
Right.
I was sitting next to Maury King, who said, you know, the military tells the soldiers when they're using these night scopes that they're not to look up into the sky.
They do. I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either. But, you know, obviously these are young kids. What's the first thing they're going to do when they're told no?
we looked up into
the sky, and here were these, they've been seeing these things zipping all over the sky. It was super quiet, and it was like a light show with these night scopes. And then I went to bed at 12:30 in the morning, but these guys were still out there at 2 o'clock in the morning, and they're still looking up there, and they saw a formation of these things in a V-shape in the formation.
Right, right.
So Ed Grimsley was saying, well, these are UFOs. The following morning, we listened to Charles Ostman talk about his stuff, and at the end of his presentation, I went back out there and told Ed Grimsley, those are no longer UFOs, they're IFOs. We know exactly what they are and what engines they're using to make these things run. They're
That's pretty amazing.
Identified flying objects.
I have looked through through the night vision goggles, and these are the same ones that Ed uses because my friend bought a pair off of Ed. And I use them to look into the sky up in Trout Lake, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And besides the normal satellites that you see, and I don't know why it is, but up there at James's Ranch, you'll see something bright fly across the sky about every minute and a half. And there just are not that many satellites up there. But it is so interesting to look through the night vision because you see about five times as many craft flying not in our atmosphere, way above our atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting.
I just thought it was fascinating. Another one of those things, it wasn't part of the conference, but everybody who was at the same hotel got to participate in these conversations that lasted well into the early morning hours. I don't know how these people did it.
Well, we do it all the time. I mean, if I could have hung around yesterday at the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, they had a star party last night. I would really have liked to have gone to it, but if I did that, I would not be down here in Idaho tonight, 20 miles away from our warehouse, getting ready to refurbish this electric car. I can't be everywhere at one time, although one of these days I'm going to figure out how to do that because I just have to be. I just got to get it all.
Well, anyhow, the people that missed the conference, they can go to our website, PES Wiki, go to the thing about the events section, and look for Extraordinary Technology Conference. We've got all of this information out there. I've got links to links and stuff that the different speakers talked about. And I've got pictures and stuff out there. But we've also got the links there to the Tesla conference website, so you can actually order these DVDs from these presenters that gave their stuff.
There you go. Now, I recommend doing that because, you know, by the time you figure the price of a plane ticket and a hotel and a rental car and all that, yes, you get the flavor of the expo. But if you didn't get a chance to get there, and by the way, if you just go to x2-radio.com, the PES Wiki link is right there on the index page. Click on it. And follow Robert's instructions there, and you can get all this information, and you can actually watch these live presentations by these world experts in these various areas of technology. Bring yourself up to date, and who knows, you might get inspired by one of them, break out the checkbook, and send one $20 a month. It will make a huge difference in the world of access to energy.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much for letting me participate with you tonight. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, and I appreciate your candor and your energy and your participation, your commitment. You certainly have great zeal for the subject, and I can tell you there are times, even in the biodiesel business, when you get bogged down in the details of welding and laying pipe and putting in tanks and programming controllers, it doesn't seem like it's ever going to get done. But this kind of energy, this kind of enthusiasm and support is exactly what we need in this industry. And I, for one, am glad that Robert Pritchard is out there doing the job.
Well, you know, I was kind of a doubting Thomas coming into this stuff. I didn't believe in the hydroxy process. And so I said, well, okay, Sterling, let me play with this stuff. Let me experiment a little around with it. And I want to find out if it's real or not. You know, he let me run with the ball. He gave me the resources to do it. And I found out this stuff really does work. This is just one of hundreds of different technologies that are out there that can help mankind.
Sure.
And we're on the bleeding edge, cutting edge, whatever edge you want to call it. We're out there touching bases with these people, meeting with them, finding out about their technologies, and going forward with it. It's just exciting to be here.
Yes, I completely agree with that. And, you know, I've got a lot of faith, I've got a lot of belief, I've got a lot of knowledge, and of course I've dedicated the last 2 years of my life to the new energy prospect. And I intend to keep going with it because the rewards are fantastic. It's going to be for everyone. Do we have a caller on the line?
Yes. This is Tom from Winston.
Hi, Tom. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Brooks. Hey, I talked to you a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
I was looking at Robert's website there, and a couple weeks ago I was talking to you about the electromagnetic healing and stuff like that.
Right, right.
And I was wondering, how many volts do they use on their pulsed electromagnetic, the PEMF, on their products that they show on there? How many volts do they usually use on a machine like that?
Are you talking about the Zero Point Research live stream generators, or what are you talking about?
The electromagnetic pulse, there are ways to, like, heal tissue and stuff like that.
Oh, that's a good question. Robert, do you know the answer to that?
Nope, I don't. But I know there's a guy that would... There's a couple of guys that could tell you. That would be Dr. Bear, John... What's his first name, John? Yeah. He's the one that does the Rife Bear engine and does this technology. There's also a couple other people that were at the conference. If you go out to our website, go to that Tesla conference page and click on the reports section. You have to scroll down quite a bit to get to it. I've got some business card contact information there. I'm going to go to it right now. And where is he?
Okay.
I'm looking. Hold on. Joshua Parker, Water Vortex.
Right, right, right. That's the one.
Yeah, he can help you.
Okay. Well, I had a company come up to my office, and I had them demo some stuff on some patients. And this thing uses from 3,000 to 11,000 volts. And I was just wondering if it was something similar to that, because I had it done on me. I was just like, you know, incredibly, I just couldn't believe what it did. And
well, the 3,000 volt ones, that's actually pretty low voltage. Some of them run in the neighborhood of 500,000 volts to 4,000,000 volts. What you have to be careful of is the frequency. You want to get as close to DC as you can get on that. You don't want to...
This is all DC.
That's good. That's good. That's the stuff.
What I was told was that in the United States, they're not allowed to use over like 11,000 volts.
Okay, I'm going to have to cut you off the air. I'm sorry.
Well, I wish we could talk about it more, but we are...
I've got a friend here in the Tri-Cities that has something similar down in his basement. It's a multi-frequency device. It's one of those that we saw at the Tesla conference. They use the tube technology from way back when. And he's in his 80s. He's still using this thing, and he's using it to cure himself from illnesses and stuff. So apparently it does work.
Yep, it does work. I can testify to that. There's a lot of energy technology out there in the health services that is really doing some amazing things. And I wish we had more time to go through it, but we are out of time for X Squared Radio this week. So I want to thank my guest, Robert Pritchard, for coming on. Thank you, Tom, for calling in. And we will be back at the same time next week, 5 p.m. Pacific, with more of X Squared Radio. I do want to thank you all for being on board. This is our third year. And we are now in the top two internet paranormal talk radio programs in the country. And we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you. We try to bring you the leading edge technology, do the best we can. It is a 3-hour program, so if you're not getting all 3 hours, please let us know. We'll talk to your affiliates and get that fixed for you. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are source. Try to find the good in people and help it to grow a little bit every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.